welcome to the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on 720 WGN. We have a jam-packed, great show lined up for you tonight. Some great guests, some good discussion, and of course the worst, 312-981-7200. All right, let's get to the show tonight. We've got an amazing show lined up. I'm so excited. Fred Willard's going to join us tonight. Fred Willard, a comic legend. And it's very interesting because he's going to be in town because the Fifth Star Awards are going to be at Millennium Park tomorrow night. This is the third annual Fifth Star Awards, which is really a way that the city, the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events honors creativity in Chicago. They give these awards to big people. This year, it's Buddy Guy. It's the Second City, which Fred Willard is presenting for. There's so many other people that are involved with that. Jackie Taylor, who was on this program. So we're going to talk to Fred Willard about his time in Chicago, dating all the way back to 1965. That was when his first main stage show at Second City was, 1965. So we'll talk with Fred Willard about what Second City here in Chicago means to him and has helped him with his career. We'll also try to talk about Christopher Guest and the new movie Mascots, which Fred Willard is in, coming out in October. Also tonight, as well as we'll have sort of a 9 o'clock themed hour around the Fifth Star Awards, Shamika Copeland's going to join us, the great blues musician who is tearing up blues charts. She was named Best Contemporary Female Artist of the Year by Blues Music, the Blues Music Awards. She's great, Chicago-based musician. She's going to be presenting Buddy Guy tomorrow night at the Fifth Star Awards. So we'll talk with Shamika Copeland about what Buddy Guy means to her, also about her career, including living and performing the blues. How do you do that? I think it's great. Also tonight, my guest at the big table, the author of Out of the Wreck I Rise, a literary companion to recovery, Neil Steinberg, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, longtime Sun-Times columnist, talking about how literature and some of the greatest writers of all time have sort of developed a path when it comes to addiction and recovery. And really, we just need to follow their amazing words. So we'll talk with Neil about his new book. We should talk to him about the chunk of concrete falling on someone's head at Union Station, but maybe we'll skip that. Maybe we'll start with that. We'll start with that, then do addiction recovery. Or should we do addiction recovery, then chunk of concrete falling on head? You know what? I'll figure it out. Also tonight, Professor Al Jeaney talks about fanaticism, a big issue in political campaigns we're seeing right now when it comes to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. We'll talk with him about when getting too siloed actually hurts you. We'll talk about that phenomenon that we're seeing on Facebook and everywhere where people are stuck in their ways and that's the only way they can look at things. We'll talk with our resident philosopher, Al Jeaney, about what to do about the ongoing trend of fanaticism. And tonight, the worst. That's right. Mars Tim's going to be here. Looking forward to it. 312-981-7200. All that coming up tonight on The Download. What a show. How are we going to get it all in? I don't know. One thing we're not talking about tonight is Chicago's taxes and fiscal crisis. That's because there's only one event that is going on right now that is covering this. Is Chicago's fiscal crisis over? It's a symposium that the Daily Line is putting on. It's the impact of new taxes and what we should expect in coming years. It's actually over at the Hotel Monaco Ballroom. Mike Fouché, who comes up on Wednesdays here, is moderating. There's great panelists, Bobby Otter, a lot of people. Craig Chico's there. Why don't we go to the Monaco Ballroom right now and pick up with industrial folks, Mike Fouché. There he is.
You've got folks that are...
Hey, I'm going to cut you out there, Brian.
Oh, the cutoff.
Oh, sorry. Hey, you know, hey, Justin, how are you? We're
Mike Fouché, how are you, buddy?
I'm terrific. Thank you very much. We're having a great conversation here at the Hotel Monaco, and we were just talking about, you know, what is the city fiscal crisis going to be looking like when we get to 2019? And folks were pointing out that in 2018, all of the city is going to have a reassessment for property taxes. And so that's something that everybody's going to be thinking about when the election time comes around, because they're going to have a whole bunch more property taxes to pay. I want to go down the list. We've got Bobby Otter from the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability and some other folks. And I want to ask each of you real quickly, can you give me a sense, how do you think that the property tax issue is going to be something and the city's fiscal crisis, is that going to be something that's going to be a campaign issue that people are going to talk about? Maybe you don't want to do that, Bobby.
I would assume so, yes.
Yeah, okay. I mean, following up, I mean, you know, Mike Reaver from the Chicagoland Chamber, is this something, I mean, voters have a really short memory. You know, is it, are people going to forget about this? We're going to have property taxes raised this year, and then people will forget about it in 2 years.
Right now, I think that it will still be in everybody's minds because of, you know, the reassessments that are coming up in 2018. But I think the important consideration is that, again, those people in those neighborhoods and those communities are not seeing an investment in the future. It's very difficult to explain, you know, paying all of this money, billions of dollars in property taxes and other taxes and fees, with no investment for the future of, you know, expanding classrooms or having the extra teachers or, you know, having more police on the streets or a lot of the issues that, you know, the city as a whole are concerned with and these questions that we're grappling with. It's very hard to sell a lack of investment when you're paying that much money in property taxes and you're not seeing a return on investment.
Brian Bernardoni from the Chicagoland Realtors, what do you say on this?
Property owners are reminded every 6 months of what their property tax burden looks like. Renters are reminded every year when they go for a renewal of the lease. So I think everyone is going to be quite erudite about what the property tax situation is. And I think they'll have a very good memory of what those costs look like when they go to the ballot box in 2019.
Erudite. We're educating everybody here. Thank you. And Craig Chico from Back of the Yards Neighborhood Council, what say you? Are we going to forget about this by 2019?
No, I don't think memories are short when it comes to people's pocketbooks, and I believe it will be fresh in our minds. And if I was a consultant working for one of the potential challengers to this administration, I'd be licking my chops. Fair or not, it's almost a death blow when you were the one that raised the taxes. I think the mayor may be able to overcome this, but if you don't make some investment into the city, especially, we haven't talked about it much, but especially into the areas that need it most, with that are suffering from violence, and this has a relationship to our budget as well, that we're going to have a tough sell.
Well, there you go, Justin. You know, I think maybe it's just a silly question. You know, if people are going to be thinking about this in 2019, but certainly seems that everyone here in our panel has been worrying about it and concerned about it.
Well, Mike, let me ask one question of you, and you can ask the panel. I'm just interested in the political ramifications. Obviously, you know, when it comes to 2019, you're talking about the political problems with raising taxes. But aren't you sort of between a rock and a hard place? If we've talked about it, Mike, the idea that why not go up front, get the tax burden out of the way so we can get out of this fiscal crisis and let the voters actually sort of say, okay, this was what we needed, a true leader to get us through this, as opposed to someone who continues to kick it down the road.
We got Bobby Otter here from CTPA. He's talking about ripping the Band-Aid off. Go ahead.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, I think the city would be much better off if it just actually made the investment, figured out what they needed, went and did it. It would create certainty, if nothing else. People aren't going to like it. People aren't going to like it if you raise it by 50% or if you raise it by 75% or if you raise it by 2%. They're going to complain. So just go do it, figure out what you need, and go get it done. I mean, I think it's going to be easier at the end of the day. And then you can even say, hey, look, I solved the problem. Even if you didn't, you can say at least I solved the problem, rather than, hey, I'm back this year. Can I raise your water taxes? Hey, I'm back this year. Can I raise your garbage fees? Hey, I'm back this year. You know, can we, you know, increase, walking down the street? I mean, like, not to sound like George Harrison.
I can't wait to pay for that.
But I mean, I think just going and doing it would create the certainty also for businesses too, that they can at least figure out, you know, how to manage this, as opposed to, you know, what are we going to get hit with this year, and how much is that going to cost us?
Hey, Mike, let me ask one more question just about, I mean, is there optimism on the panel or pessimism when it comes to the idea of, just for our WGN radio audience, of the idea of us getting out of this fiscal situation that the city's in?
Brian Berno, Doni.
Well, I think the panel has just asked every member of the city council to take on the profile of that John Kennedy asked for, with this profiles of courage, that everyone just put their political careers at risk and vote the right way. And if we know Chicago's history, we can probably predict the outcome of what that really looks like at the end of the day. I think everyone's optimistic that the city can do better and that will grow, but I think the foundations haven't been set forth to create that yet.
So there you go.
There you go.
Optimism leavened by pessimism.
Mike Boucher in the panel. Is Chicago's fiscal crisis over? It's happening right now at the Hotel Monaco Ballroom right here on Wabash. Mike, continue the good stuff, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks a lot.
All right. There you go. Mike Boucher. How fun is that? jump in. That's a great idea. Just jump into little panel discussions that are happening all over the city. That's the Daily Line, of course. And the event is Chicago's Fiscal Crisis Over, the impact of new taxes and what we should expect in the coming years. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back, and we will do the carryout. Stay with us. Let's get the show on the road. It's a download here in 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's start the show like we do every show with the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. New conspiracy theories are suggesting that Hillary Clinton had a body double when she came out of her daughter's apartment after the fainting spell on Sunday. Her weight, her nose, and the length of her fingers are being scrutinized online. Hey, I could buy that there are several robot Hillarys all over the country, Manchurian candidate style, to make sure that the D.C. industrial complex can retain power and keep the fat cats feeding from the trough. Or, I don't know, she took a shower? Either way, they both make sense, right? But which one makes more sense? Yeah, the shower. A congressional committee was busy at work today investigating Hillary Clinton emails again. A State Department staffer was a no-show for the hearing, saying that he will evoke his right not to testify. Some in Congress consider this a witch hunt to give Clinton a black eye during the presidential run. But others say this is a witch hunt to give Clinton a black eye during a presidential run. So either way. Let me just say, if this was such a big deal, why not follow what Newsweek is reporting and ask George W. Bush to testify about the 22 million missing emails he's got from his administration, not to mention avoiding subpoenas and hiding material sensitive to the war in Iraq, and that Colin Powell has told the press he did the same thing that Clinton did. But you know what? The past is the past. And more importantly, didn't Clinton's arms look hairier when she came out of her daughter's place? I mean, I don't think it's her. I think it's the man, baby. Excuse to get a Austin Powers quote in there. Every show you gotta. A piece of concrete fell from the rafters at Union Station and hit a passenger, causing a skull fracture. So I guess you can't say, well, my train's late, but it could be worse anymore. No word on whether or not this will expedite the renovations at the old train station. Oh, this just in. It won't. A new report says that 50 years ago, the sugar lobby worked to pin all bad food news on fat. Yep, creating the diet craze and all that comes with it, when in fact, sugar has been the big culprit for this country's obesity epidemic and heart disease. When asked for comment, Sugar was like, shh, just take another spoonful. You know you love me. Shh. How can I stay mad at Sugar, right? You just can't. So good. The damage of Grant Park during this year's Lollapalooza is up over $400,000. No worries. Lolla picks up the tab. Although the park is closed to the public while fixed. But hey, no charge to the taxpayers. But 400 grand to fix damage to a park? How expensive were those flowers? How much money is Lolla making on this deal? Actually, the better question is, how much is Chicago making off of Lolla? It better be more than 400 grand. In weather, the last perfect day of the year? Possibly. Rain and cool weather coming through next. In sports, the Cubs' magic number down to 3 after last night's victory against the Cardinals. Kyle the Calculator Hendricks was adding up outs last night, but he came up a few short of a no-hitter right after umpire Joe West wouldn't let the infielders come in to talk to Hendricks, which made Coach Madden mad. He was ejected, and in the melee, well, Chapman was able to warm up, so everybody wins, right? You know who doesn't win? Umpire Joe West, because I know his name. I'm not supposed to know the umpire's name. Who's this guy? He gone. The Cubs send Ham Jam, Jason Hamill, to the mound tonight in St. Louis. The Sox try to play spoiler with the Indians, who currently lead the AL Central. The Sox won last night. Let's see him try to win 2 in a row, shall we? How cool would that be? Unprecedented. The Indians are 6 games up on the Tigers right now, so who cares? The Bears' Jekyll and Hyde performance on Sunday and the loss to the Texans hurt them in the weekly power rankings. Most analysts have them near the bottom of the league, including Phil Simms, who has them 30th. That's just ahead of the Rams and the Browns. Let that sink in, Bears fans. The Rams and the Browns. Fox talked to the media today and announced no new injuries. All the injuries, the same as before. So there you have it. Tons of info for you, the Bears fan, to consume. The Rams and the Browns. Ugh. Big game for new linebacker Jarrell Freeman, though. He was credited with 17 tackles on Sunday. Wow, Freeman wears number 50, which is absurd, right? I know the Bears organization went crazy retiring numbers back then, but suck it up and make him wear something different, like number 39. I know Lemuel Stinson was good, but he wasn't Singletary good, right? 39. Jarrell Freeman, welcome to your new number. You're going to be great. 39. In WNBA news, MVP Elena Delladon underwent thumb surgery and will be out for an undisclosed amount of time. Not good, with the playoffs right around the corner. I should probably fact check that because I really don't know when the WNBA playoffs begin. And finally tonight, who needs safe spaces and trigger warnings when you're the top three? The University of Chicago was named the third best university in the country by U.S. News and World Report. The only two schools ahead of them, Harvard and Princeton. Other schools in the area, Northwestern was 12th, University of Illinois was 44th, and ITT was 86th. Oh, I'm sorry. No, they were 86th. Sixth. Okay, close. Got it. My bad. That's the carry out for September 13th, 2016. Hey, I hope you like your paper bags greasy. Hey, deal with it. It's the mark of a true Chicagoan. Who doesn't love a greasy paper bag? All right, coming up, Professor Al Genie, the resident philosopher, will talk about fanaticism and how it's playing out in the political election, and more importantly, your social media feed. Seems like we in trouble. That's coming up here on The Download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, let's get to the news. How you doing, Rob Martier?
I'm doing well, and you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm ready good. For tonight. You know, I got to get ready for Fred Willard. I'm ready.
Oh, man, I can't wait.
I don't know if I ask him about Best in Show or I ask him about Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap,
he's got the greatest role in that, where he's the Air Force.
I don't want to get you too close to the van. They might think I'm one of you. Okay, I'm joking, of course.
No. Don't touch that one. Don't even look at it. Hey, this one goes to 11.
Fred Willard coming
classic.
Up at 9 o'clock.
He's
hour.
Very good. All right. Very good.
Well,
all right.
It's coming up. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, political season is obviously wrapping up soon. Whew, what a dandy when it comes to news and information. You really got two choices. You either can check out, like a lot of people are doing right now, or dig in, which is something that we've seen more this year than ever. People set in their way, and they will not change. If you don't believe me, check Facebook. But that's what we're going to talk about tonight, because it really does feel like it's getting to the point of fanatic behavior. And Professor Al Genie, our resident philosopher, agrees, and he is here in studio. He's a professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University. Good to see you, Professor.
Good to see
you.
How are you? Fine. It's been a long, strange summer, but I'm glad to be here.
So, I mean, this is something that we've been seeing over and over, and it's this idea of somebody having political beliefs and sticking to
right.
it as if it's almost the truth.
Now, this notion of fanaticism is part of the history of our culture and part of our politics. I mean, I hate to say this because he's a cultural hero in one sense. Thomas Jefferson paid a publicist, we'll call him a publicist at the time, to write a scandalous book about John Adams, in which he was also accused, I think, of being a pedophile. I mean, the fanaticism involved, because the founding fathers were worried
right.
about
the Republic. So this Republic. Is not new.
Not new, but not I think this it's last new. Campaign and the last 24 years of presidential politics, including Clinton, Bush, and Obama, there's been a new form of fanaticism, a new stubbornness, almost a zealotry about our particular parties, an unwillingness to look at other things. And I think this is hurting the body politic. I think this is affecting how we do politics and how we look at opponents. And I think what it's come down to, and if you look at, you know, Obama has said this, that I'm stymied. Bush said this, I'm stymied. Clinton certainly said he was stymied. He may have been the cause of some of that, his own self, but nevertheless, that we've lost the ability to be fair with opponents. And one of the reasons mm-hmm. for that, and this predates you, in Washington, up until sometime after the Lyndon Johnson, before the advent of planes that got you across the country in 3 hours, the senators and congresspeople lived in Washington. They knew each other.
So you think the idea of not having proximity, not spending
time
outside of the chambers
that's right.
has something to do with it?
I've been at cocktail – I mean, long time ago, I've been at cocktail parties with Barry Goldwater and Ted Kennedy. In fact, met them on a camping trip in Arizona. This notion that we may be political opponents, but we were the comfortable opposition or the committed opposition. But now I think what's happening is – We've lost the alternative to look for alternatives, to look for options, to look for some middle ground. And that's moving more and more towards fanaticism. And, you know, we think of fanaticism as simply a derivation of fan. I'm a fan. I love the sports. And I love the Cubs. I love the Bears. Well, let me come back to that. I love the Cubs right now and see what happens. But fanaticism really is this notion of being zealot, being unable to be reflective of any other position or any other point of view.
Is that, I mean, do you see that playing out in a way that is aided by social media? It's aided by the fact that people feel like this is their page, this is their Facebook page, their Twitter page. They can do whatever they want, and they don't have to compromise. They're not
I think social media, in one sense, has been a great advantage to all of us, that everyone has the right to their say, and their say can be seen by everyone. And the converse of that is everyone has a right to their say, but not every fool is right. And you get a lot of stuff out there, but it's becoming a conflagration of negativity. That's a horribly pompous phrase, but I think there's certain, you know, coming together of this negativity. And what it's suggesting is more than just, I am absolutely committed to be a Democrat, I'm absolutely committed to be a Republican. It's bordering on narcissism, and I think it's bordering on something that sociologists call ethnocentrism, the belief that any other belief beyond your own mm-hmm. is not fully human, is not fully valid, is not fully accepted. And to come back to your social media, I think the fires of that are fanned by social media.
Well, I mean, just look at the basis of the way it works. If you like something that's being said, you hit the word like.
Right.
Like there's something there in the idea that there's just it becomes an echo chamber.
A similar example of that is the notion of Obama still not being an American citizen. I mean, that's still a living issue being debated in social media and other places. And to me, that's a representation of, if you are not like me, then you are not fully one of us.
Well, I mean, okay. So, I mean, obviously you said the last 20, 25 years that we've seen this blow up. But as you mentioned at the top, Thomas Jefferson writing scandalous books about his political opponents. I mean, it is something that is hardwired in humanity. I mean, is this something that goes back to say, yes, people believe in what they believe in, therefore they're human?
Well, this is when I put the philosophical cap on. Yes, it's hardwired in our humanity. Yes, we are competitive, combative creatures. But I always thought that the purpose of egalitarian democracy was to rise somewhat above that, to talk about issues and places. Look, Abraham Lincoln, the saint, the secular saint of our society, was reviled, and cartoons of him as an ape appeared in papers. The kinds of things were said about him in papers, he'd be a rich man by today's standards if he just sued one of them. The man he hired to be Secretary of War actually refused to hire him when he saw him the first time, and he said to his face to a colleague, "I will not hire this man. He looks like a long-armed gorilla." And, you know, I mean, the way people would talk about people, it's always been part of it. But I thought we were trying to raise the bar in a democracy. I thought we were trying to raise issues instead of wicked Hillary or stupid Donald.
I'll go past that, because it obviously happens in fanaticism happens in sports. We see it in sports.
Oh.
Our team can do no wrong. We see it in politics now. But what I think is interesting is it's playing out in issues. We see it with movements like Black Lives Matter or Blue Lives Matter. We see it in economics. We see it in so many other places where that fanaticism has gone even further.
Yeah.
It's permeated itself into
That's exactly what I mean. Biologists sometimes call this pseudo-speciation. That is, you believe that your particular point of view is the only acceptable point of view, and therefore all other points of view are not only wrong, they're aberrant. And they cannot be tolerated, and they should be eradicated. So there's a real danger to that. That happens all the time, and I take this term from biology and Conrad Lorenz, happens all the time, certainly in combat, that you didn't kill a German from the Rhineland or from, you know, Berlin. You killed a Nazi. In the Pacific, my uncle did not shoot Nipponese. He shot Japs. So this notion of stripping a people of their human characteristics is part of it. And
so we don't have to understand their point of view.
We don't have to understand the point of view. In fact, you can reject their point of view. And that's what I'm hearing now. To my ear, what I hear is this kind of vitriol from various politicians and participants in the field, including individuals, that they are so locked into their point of view that they denigrate and deny the humanity of the opposite.
Professor Al Genie with us here, our resident philosopher on the download. We're talking about fanaticism and how it's creeping out of where we've made it acceptable, sports.
Yeah.
And it's moved to politics, news, issues, and beyond. Let me ask you about just the way capitalism plays a role in this, because we've seen media companies really try to create echo chambers. We see this with MSNBC or Fox, and this is well documented. This is not something I'm bringing up. But the concept being that, you know, they recognize that this is something that's in humanity, and they are strengthening it for the idea of ratings and to make money.
Absolutely.
Does that play a role when you talk about it amplifying?
It does play a role. And even, you know, even giving the channels that I would maybe be drawn to, let's say a more liberal channel, Rachel, I've forgotten her name right now.
Maddow
right now. It's vitriol coming out of there. There's really negativity coming out of there. Oh, my God. Here's another idea by the opposition. How could they be thinking of it? Instead of debating it for its particular good points or bad points, instead of counter-arguments as counterfactual expression, both are an attempt to put us in different camps. And when that happens, there's no middle ground, Justin. What happens is you have permanent opposition, and that, I think, diminishes real progress. So what you have are these sanctuaries of perfection, and everything in the middle simply isn't important. And when that happens, nothing gets done. You know, the police chief in Chicago right now, I know this is a very tender topic, and I don't want to offend anyone by my comments. He came out and finally said, this isn't entirely a police problem. This is a sociological problem. This is a problem of poverty in the cities. This is a problem of people with no other options, et cetera, et cetera. Let's not denigrate only the police, but it's so easy to only denigrate one thing. Because in some sense, we can control the police. We could fire all of them, possibly. But we can't eradicate poverty. That's too hard. And so rather than doing the hard problems, we go to the stereotypes. And that's what I think fanaticism gets to us. And dare I offer you a quote that I think encapsulates what I'm talking about. During World War II, Heinrich Himmler was head of the Gestapo and head of the SS, and a true believer. And full disclosure, he formed the Gestapo using as his metaphor the works of Ignatius of Loyola and the meditations. That is, he wanted organization, total commitment, total fraternity, and total dedication. And so he's giving this exercise. He's giving a graduation speech to the new SS officers. And he says, and I quote, "Whether our nations live in other nations live in prosperity or croak from hunger interests me only insofar as we need them for slaves for our culture. Otherwise, it does not interest me. Whether 10,000 Russian females drop from exhaustion while building anti-tank ditches interests me only insofar as that we need anti-tank ditches to save the German people. Our concern, our duty, is our people and our blood. Toward anything else, we can be indifferent. I wish the SS to take this attitude in confronting the problem of all alien, non-Germanic peoples, especially the Russians. All else is just soup and bubbles."
Sounds like a lovely person.
Lovely person. Now, that's the most radical form of it.
But that's a great point, because fanaticism has reared its ugly head. You know, we've had passion around other politics and sports and news and issues before, but it does get out of whack where you have, Heinrich Himmler, who's essentially talking to an army.
Right.
Saying this is the fanaticism at its worst.
And don't feel bad about doing that. And even, you know, in a much more benign sense, we both are passionate football fans, and I really enjoyed it. And I was up late watching the Notre Dame game against Texas and so on and so forth. And I called my friend from Notre Dame the next day. I said, boy, what a game. And he just, you know, put daggers in my eyes for saying that. What do you mean we didn't win? And went on and on and on. Now, that was being jocular. Mm-hmm. But what frightens me is the tone, the temper, and the vitriol of present political discourse leads to anonymity rather than unity.
Okay, so how do we fix it? I mean, that's what the download's all about these days. How do we fix it? We know what the problems are. Is fanaticism a fixable thing?
I'm not sure, but I do know it begins with conversations that are not always hostile. We're not always threatening others. One of the things we learn in schools of business, and I think this is a wonderful phenomenon, you're negotiating for something. You're a business person. You want X, and you're willing to pay Y. He wants to get rid of X, but he needs R. How do we get to the equation where that's acceptable? If you make this personal, this is going to fall out of sync, and it's not going to happen. And finally, let's say I sell this issue for less than I really wanted, but more than I realistically thought I would get. And I bought it for a little more than I wanted, but not as much as I was willing to go for because I wanted. Then you've got a transaction. I think transactions are what we're talking about in political spheres.
Interesting.
We don't have transactions. We have alienation.
Well, the art of the compromise. That'll be the next.
Art of the compromise.
There you go. Professor Al Genie, he's the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola. He also is the resident philosopher here on The Download. Al, great to see you.
See you soon.
All right, coming up here on The Download, Neil Steinberg's in studio, the longtime columnist of the Chicago Sun-Times and the author of Out of the Wreck I Rise, a literary companion to recovery. He's here. He's my guest at the big table. Coming up also in the tonight in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to celebrate the Fifth Star Awards on the show. Fred Willard, the great Fred Willard, great comedian who got his start here in Chicago at the Second City back in 1965. We'll talk about his relationship and what the Second City gave him to be able to tackle a career in Hollywood. Also, Shamika Copeland will join us, great blues musician. She'll talk about her relationship with Buddy Guy. Buddy Guy also getting a Fifth Star Award. So that's all coming up on the show at 9 o'clock. And then at 10 o'clock, we'll play The Worst. This, of course, where we complain about the worst things in our society for prizes. It's very simple. It's a download here on WGN Radio. Thanks, Rob. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Like I said, right before the news, Fred Willard joins us in the 9 o'clock hour, as well as blues star Shamika Copeland, and we'll play The Worst. Mars Timms will be back. So all that coming up tonight here on The Download. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is a Chicago columnist and author. Neil Steinberg's new book is called Out of the Wreck I Rise, A Literary Companion to Recovery. If you or someone you know is in recovery, dealing with an addiction, and you're looking for a path, look no further than some of the greatest writers of our time. Steinberg collects selections, cuttings, and quotes from Shakespeare, Bukowski, Hemingway, and Dante, just to name a few, to illustrate that addiction and recovery is not a new concept for human beings, and there are wise words that can help you on the journey ahead. Neil and co-writer Sarah Bader have created a resource that leans heavily on the power of literature to shine a light on our impulses, addictions, and how we overcome. Neil is a columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times, and he's my guest tonight on The Download. Neil, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Justin.
It's, you know, this is a great book, and
thank
and it's
you.
Something that I mean, it's something I know that was a lot of work to be able to put all of these quotes together.
Almost
a lot
five
of work
years.
It took 5 years to put this together.
Yeah.
What were you trying to accomplish with this?
Addiction is confusing to a lot of people. They think it's just this stupid choice you make, even people who are in it and in rehab, and they don't quite understand what's happening. And I wanted to explain what addiction was and how recovery worked. And rather than be technical and have a lot of scientific terms, rather than talk about God, I wanted to talk about people who'd been through it. And it happened to be that a lot, you know, you go back to Homer and he talks about wine. And I figured I found power in these things. This really started by me doing my reading and marking things that sounded true to me that I wanted to remember. And as I put them together, I thought, you know, you could have a narrative. You could take someone. That's why it's called a companion.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
it's not a guide. It doesn't tell you how to do it. It's not a 12-step program. But it's something that kind of help you understand and help make meaningful. You know, it's easy to give things up and to give up drinking. People who are alcoholics do it all the time. The hard part is to stay quit. And the way you do that is you form part of the book is trying to make recovery heroic. Okay, to say this is an adventure. You didn't lose the good part of your life, and now you have to sit around in the bad part till you die. This can be the good part of your life too.
Well, what's great about it is it illustrates that addiction and recovery is not a new concept. It's not a new age concept by any stretch. This is something like you mentioned. I mean, you have at the beginning of time or beginning of the written word, passages and creativity and poetry and writing around the concept of impulse control, impulse addiction, recovery, all the things that are really with us today in 2016.
There's a chapter on relapse because relapse is such an important part. You know, Philip Seymour Hoffman, he's straight for 20 years and then he goes, oh, I think I'll take some heroin and dies. Okay. And the way we structure the chapter is around this English diarist named Samuel Pepys in the 1660s. And he was this very frank diarist writing in code about sexual liaisons under London Bridge and things. And I thought, you know, I bet he drinks a lot. And he does. And the beauty part of it being a diary is there are dates on it. So you see him on September 12th, 1662, making this vow to God that he's going to stop drinking wine. And then you see him on September 29th with a bunch of aldermen and captains and things, and they're going at it again. And so it's a beautiful way to convey that kind of head on a board repetition that relapse does, where you go to a program and you're doing fine and everything's great and then you're back again in it.
Right.
And so, again, I didn't even know that he drank, but I just guessed that he probably did. And the chapter is called Upon Breach of My Late Vows. Every chapter starts with a quote. And so the quote is from Pepys, and he says, I went to the silversmith and I got a poor box to put some coins in upon breach of my late vows. And then there's an essay where I say the vows he was breaking was to give up wine and theater. For some reason, theater was another sin, and he was always giving them up together. And so I use Pepys to sort of – and this is before there was alcolism, before people really knew anything.
Right.
I mean, and they
there may not have been a name for it.
Right. But they knew that – I mean they know it's bad in the Bible. There's a quote from the Bible where he says – where in Joel where they say, you know, awake, you drinkers of wine, and weep, for the wine is cut off from your mouth. And then they go straight to Hemingway, where Hemingway says, I didn't think they could take wine away from me, but they can. And that's one thing about the quotes. They sort of one sort of hands off to another in a very kind of sometimes subtle, sometimes strong way.
Well, obviously, you know, drinking is a big part of the vices that are explored with a lot of the writers here. And there's a lot of other addictions and vices included. But it is interesting because the romanticizing of alcohol or drinking and writing. There always has been that. I mean, whether it be Hemingway or any of the other writers, there's this connection between the vice and the writer, and it's glorified a lot
sure,
in the sort of mainstream,
expected.
But never the part where they're trying to get clean.
That's why I specifically put in something from Gonzo, which is the oral history of Hunter S. Thompson. And we think of him, and he's so cool, and he's so great. And in the family chapter, I put in a quote from his girlfriend where she's basically saying how desperately she tried to get him into rehab, and he had all these requirements, so he had to be by the water, and he had to be here and had to be there, and she finally got him into this place, and then some drug dealer he found was coming to bail him out, and she said, no, please let him stay, and the drug dealer says, hey, this is Hunter S. Thompson, man, and she says, I realized then that there's always going to be that guy, and there were so many more of him than there were of me, and it was so sad. And then there was a quote from Jan Wenner from his editor at Rolling Stones basically saying he was an alcoholic and it wrecked his career. And that's the part you don't really see.
Right, right.
And again, it's not to undermine. I have great respect for Hunter S. Thompson as a writer, but he could have been here now. You know, as someone who's an alcoholic myself, I definitely remember thinking when I was drinking, this is who I am. I'm a drunk, and I'm going to keep on drinking and drinking and drinking, then I'm going to die. And the idea of giving it up was sort of this weird alien thing that my wife was pushing on me, and I really didn't think that was just ridiculous. And one part of the book was I wanted to sort of build a romance of sobriety. And say, no, you know, because people think, oh, Keith Richards is so exciting.
Yeah, that's right.
And I quote from his book where he says, I had to give up heroin because when you're a junkie, eventually all you know are junkies, and junkies are idiots, okay? And to hear Keith Richards say that, he has a certain authority that other people don't have. And so, I like the classics. I like the Iliad and the Aeneid, and I use them in here. I use the Aeneid a lot, Virgil, where he says, yield not to evils, but go forth all the more boldly to face them. Now, when everything else is falling apart, that's a plan. Okay, I find that, I memorize that in Latin, tuna sidi malis, yield not to evils.
Well, I want to talk to you more. Let's take a quick break. I want to talk to you about your relationship with the written word and how the prose and the poetry and the creativity that you found in these writers helped you in your life. Neil Steinberg, the columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times, also the author of Out of the Wreck I Rise, a literary companion to recovery. He's my guest tonight at the Big Table. Stay with us. It's a download here in 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Neil Steinberg, the great Chicago Sun-Times columnist and the author of Out of the Wreck I Rise, a literary companion to recovery. We've got to talk about the Union Station brick story that you had today that
yes,
is going to be the biggest story of the year, it
apparently,
seems like.
Nothing's ever happened like it.
So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I want to continue the conversation about addiction and recovery. This is a story that's close to you, obviously, because you've lived it.
Right. I drank every day. I was a hard-bitten Jack Daniels at the Billy Goat kind of guy. And my wife hated it, and we kind of had increasing tension over it. And one day I slapped the phone away from her, and she sent me to jail. And the Cook County judge said 28 days of rehab. You can either do it in Cook County Jail or you can do it outside. And I said, I'd like to do it outside, please. And so I was at Chapman Center at Highland Park Hospital. And I hadn't planned on writing anything, but there was also an anorexia clinic there. And I wrote a little description of these anorexics, how they were kind of wraith-like and sexless and angelic and just what they were like. And I sent it to my agent just because I was used to that. And she goes, oh, this could be a book. And I just grabbed the book like a drowning man because I didn't understand recovery. It was something I was being forced to do to stay out of jail. Mm-hmm. But I'm a big fan of Dante. And what Dante teaches you is if you find yourself in hell, you take notes. And so
Did you know that at the time, though? I mean, were you able to sort of say, you know, I really like how Dante, or was that something that just...
Well, I had read it, and it wasn't... No, I'm kind of joking. That's kind of joking. It's not like, oh, I'm following Dante. I mean, it's a cliche through hell.
Right.
What it was, to me, writing makes something meaningful, okay? If I walk out of here and two guys pull me in an alley and start to beat me with a pipe, I'll think, wow, you know, this will be a good column, right? I mean, and then maybe that's a sickness, but I was a columnist in junior high school, Justin. I was a columnist in high school. I was a columnist in college, a columnist when I was 23. I've been doing this all my life, okay?
And it's an expression for you.
It's an expression. Writing, I mean, when I first started my recovery memoir, Drunkard, which is what it came out in 2008, I thought it was originally called Booze Triumphant in my mind. And the hook was going to be, because a recovery memoir is like a romance novel. There's a million of them. And I wanted to do something different. And this one would be the one where you go back to drinking at the end. And the last page is me holding up the Jack Daniels instead of flipping off the reader. And that's how I thought until about halfway through rehab, till I suddenly realized, oh, wait, this is a real problem. I mean, honesty is important, and I realized I just couldn't stop.
So right at the beginning of your rehab, you were analytical. You were thinking about how this was a story. You weren't taking it seriously.
I wanted to because I had to do it. And I figured, you know, if you have to do something, I mean, a lot of people shrug it off and they sit there with their arms folded. Remember, my boss was an Englishman, and he called me. He says, so you're doing this sobriety thing seriously. He just couldn't believe it. And I said, well, Michael, given the fact that I could lose my job and lose my family and lose my life and go to jail, yeah, I thought I'd give it a whirl. You know, so I did sort of have a sort of like, well, I'm here. I'm in traffic school. I might as well pay attention to the rules, right? So I was accepting it in that way. But doing the book sort of gave me a structure. In other words, I wasn't a guy who had been suspended from his job and threatened, you know, humiliated in public, you know, people laughing at me for what had gone on. I was, in the miserable drunk in rehab. I was an author writing a book. So it was a little bit of status.
Right,
I mean, the book was much funnier originally, and they ended up cutting out a lot of the funny lines. And one, I'm checking into Highland Park Hospital, and the nurse says, of course, your being here is completely confidential. And I said, you know, my being here is in the New York Post this morning. So the confidentiality thing, it's sort of gone.
What was that like, man? What was it like for you to have the issue where you were arrested and have it play out in newspapers where everybody, I mean, you, in a way, and I don't take any light, but the idea of it almost being pre-internet in the way that there weren't comments and people commenting about your life. But what was it like to not only have this addiction play out, to have everything in the papers, to have everybody talking about it?
I mean, part was horrible. There was one point early on where it was coming out in the Sunday Tribune, and I pulled out the Metro section, and there it was across the entire top of page 3 like a school fire. And I was in a health club with my brother. He had taken me to go work out. And I looked at these staircase up to some balcony, and I thought of just running up and pitching over it was the worst. I won't sugarcoat it. It was just, you know, as a guy who's proud of himself and considered himself a big deal columnist and all that, to be sitting there playing balloon volleyball in a therapy class in Highland Park, it was the bottom pit of hell. It really was. But at one point I realized that I had to fix this. Okay, this was a real problem. My wife went to go sit with her brother who had cancer in California. And I figured, oh, great, 8 days at home. I can drink for 6 of them and then stop. But when those 6 days went by, I couldn't stop. And it was that not being able to stop. It's really scary. You know, people, they think of addiction as just sort of the get-out-of-jail-free card that jerks wave when they're caught. But what addiction is at its heart is it's a compulsion. It's an obsession. After you stop, you have months, if not years, where you wake up every day and it's the first thing you think of. And you think of it the entire day and then you go to bed. Okay, and that's what alcoholism is. And if you drink, it sort of goes away. But if you don't drink in the beginning, it's just always there. And these quotes, I mean, really, it started almost with Walt Whitman. If you're familiar with Whitman, he was a nurse in the Civil War, and Leaves of Grass, it tends to you. The one quote I use in the book, he says, "Oh, despairer, here is my neck. By God, you will not go down. Hang your full weight upon me. I buoy you up. I dilate you with tremendous breath." And just this image of Walt, like, putting his arm around you and pulling you to his big bearded face. I love that. And it really sort of gave me true comfort when I had nothing else.
Well, you talk about it, or other writers talk about it. You also talk about it in the book, but this concept of leaving a life behind, or being fearful of leaving a life behind. Like, you like that life. You like the dream. You like everything about it.
Yep.
What's the fear is what's to come.
The thing with me is, you know, it's funny. I people over my house and there's beer in the refrigerator and they're kind of shocked. I'm like, hey, Sandy, you want a beer? He's like, oh, no, I couldn't drink in front of you. And I'm like, well, you know, if you don't drink it, no one does. It's from the party 3 months ago. So to me, I'm not anti-alcohol. I think it's great. I'm anti-alcoholism. And I boil it down, because I'm a writer, to one sentence. And that one sentence is, and it's not in the book, it's because it's mine. I didn't quote myself. That seemed ego. The sentence is, it's no fun if you have to. If you have to do it, it's no fun.
Right.
And you're just a slave. And I do quote people talking about that, where people, you know, Chesterton, where he says, you know, people think that drinking is wild, but it's actually slavery. And people think that it's exciting, but it's actually the worst kind of tedium. And that's true, because every day is the same. You know, it's where's the bar?
Yeah, the fun comes out of it. It's
like having a bad job. Okay, it's something you have to do every day. And the thing was, the reason I wrote this book was you have to replace it with something. If you're just a person who gave up the greatest thing in the world, and now you're stumbling through your empty life, shorn of the one thing you liked, you're going to go back to that eventually. Okay, one fine day you're going to look up and go, I don't care what the truth is. I just want to have a life that means something. And so, you know, and again, I don't want to portray myself as like the, you know, and any recovery is sort of it's a rigged together thing. Okay, I'm hoping I can pull this off. I pulled it off for almost 10 years now, and I'm hoping I have at least another 10. I'm confident about today and tomorrow, and, you know, you don't want to sign any checks you can't cash. But on the other hand, I really think, for myself, I'm not saying every single person has to start reading Seneca in order to stay sober. But when you first go into recovery, they slap you into AA, and AA gives you God and the fellowship of other alcoholics. And I never believed in God for a second in my life, and other people kind of creep me out. And so what it was giving, it was very useful. And again, some people were kind of saying, the plain dealer talked to me today. I'm going to Cleveland next week. And they said, so you think you've got something better than AA? I said, no. I said, that's why the word companion is in there. Okay, if AA works for you.
But these words of these writers you look up to, these writers that you have emulated but also wanted to be like, these words are what you find strength in, because
absolutely,
they went through the same things you did.
David Foster Wallace, if you read Infinite Jest, it's an 1,100-page novel, and it's about two things. It's about tennis, and it's about Alcoholics Anonymous in Boston. And there's an enormous passage that we quote where he's talking about what it's like. And that's it. He has it perfect. It is exact, to my experience, it is the best thing ever written. And you don't have to read 1,100 pages of Infinite Jest, although I recommend it if you can stand it.
You mentioned the concept of sort of everything was a book to get through rehab. You were thinking about it as a book.
Right.
At what point did you take the arms and unfold them and open up? Do you remember the moment where you said,
you know what
all
it
right,
is?
I buy this. I get this.
One thing, it's when other people come to you and they want help, and suddenly you're trying to explain to them. My neighbor was also in rehab, and I'm trying to say to him, you know, what would you do if your daughter came to you and said, Dad, drinking's the most important thing in the world to me, and I can't give it up. What would you tell her? Okay, and suddenly I'm the welcome wagon for sobriety. And the guy who's at the Drake having martinis with Bill Zemme, suddenly he's thinking to himself, what are you saying? You know, and I think that's when you realize you're sort of on the team. Because, you know, part of it is you put a life together and you go, you know, nobody ever looks to the day before and goes, oh, boy, I wish I drank more. Okay, and no one says, I wish I drank more last week. I wish I had been drinking for the past 5 years. You don't wish that. And so given the fact that you don't miss it in the past, and I mean, so the future is kind of hard. You find yourself thinking, boy, if I go to France, what am I going to do? And for me, I guess a breakthrough is I went to London in 2009. Lou Sussman, the American ambassador, invited me to come over and give a speech. And my first thought, you know, any alcoholic's first thought was, I can't get on the plane. I can't sit in business class for 7 hours while they pour wine on either side of me. And I made myself a deal. I'm always making myself deals. I said, go. And you have one rule, just don't drink. And if you have a lousy time, you come home, divorce your wife, go back to drinking. And, you know, if you can't do it. And I had the best time in London. I was giving a speech in the speaker's corner on a milk crate. And I was at parties where I was the only guy not drinking. And I had a better time than when I went to London drinking.
There you go. Neil Steinberg is the author of Out of the Wreck I Rise, A Literary Companion to Recovery. Let's take a break, get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. I'd love for you to read some of these,
some of the
things that you put together here. It really is inspiring. And Neil Steinberg, the columnist from the Chicago Sun-Times, is with us until 9 o'clock. So stay with us. We will be back here on The Download. Thanks, Rob. It's the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin, my guest in studio at the big table tonight, Chicago Sun-Times columnist Neil Steinberg. His new book is called Out of the Wreck I Rise, A Literary Companion to Recovery. We're talking about his life story, his battles with addiction, his success with recovery. But, you know, as so you far. Say as you yeah. say in the book, one so far, to, right? Yeah, one day at yeah. a time, only looking one or two days down the line. One of the great things about this book, and we were kind of talking about it in the news break, is just the concept that all these great thinkers, these great authors and people who, I mean, everyone from Bukowski to Hemingway to, you know.
Ricky Gervais. Ricky Gervais. Not all high tone, yeah, Homer Simpson, yeah, sure. Spider-Man 2.
Well, okay, but the point being that these – they went as far in their works to write about their struggles, to write about what alcohol or drugs or whatever their vices meant to them and what they were going through. How does that work for you as a writer, as somebody who writes on a daily basis? I mean, what's your relationship with the written word and how do you use it to help you with your recovery?
Well, to be a journalist, you have to care about what's true. And that puts you in the realm for AA because honesty is very important. Okay, you have to say, you know, there's a quote from Robert Lowe in the book, yet why not say what happened? And it's very liberating. This is something people are very much ashamed of. Okay, and people, you know, because I'm so public about it, people are often like, well, God, aren't you embarrassed, Neil? And I have a pat line I came up with. I said, you know, I wasn't embarrassed to be this notorious sponge, you know, reeling around town, soaking up every drop of booze I get my hands on. Why would I be embarrassed that I got better? And I think that's true. I mean, I see the written word as sort of something that helps me understand what's happening. I mean, that's the beauty of the telling. I mean, a lot of recovery is telling stories, and it's why do you do that? And you tell stories because you're trying to make sense of things. You're trying to figure out what happened so maybe you can change. And change is very difficult for people. That's the Ricky Gervais quote, mm-hmm. is that when you change, people don't like it, even if it's a change for the better, because almost like a part of them dies. You know, they expect you to be a certain way.
It's hard to evolve, right?
Yeah, and there's a Tom Waits quote in there. He says, well, if you act like other people expect you, then you don't have to figure out who you are. You just have to ask somebody else. And that's not a good way to be.
Well, let's read some of these. Okay. I mean, we've been talking about it. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff in here. I mean, there's probably...
I picked out something because this shows, you know, the book is sort of, I call it a mosaic. Okay. These are not just quotes that are put together by theme, but they're sort of fit together so they convey kind of a narrative. And this is early on in the chapter called, I Don't Want to Do That. It's a line from a Thurber short story. And it's where you know something's amiss, but you don't do anything typically until something terrible happens. And so this is leading up to the terrible thing that's going to happen. And I want you to notice how one quote sort of leads to another. It starts like this. Footfalls echo in the memory, down the passage which we did not take, toward the door we never opened, into the rose garden. T.S. Eliot, Burnt Norton. Disaster can be a fine designer, better than a pencil sometimes. It can lead you to safety. David Easterly, The Lost Carving. When the beginnings of self-destruction enter the heart, it seems no bigger than a grain of sand. It is a headache, a slight case of indigestion, an infected finger. But you miss the 8:20 and arrive late at the meeting on credit extensions. The old friend that you meet for lunch suddenly exhausts your patience, and in an effort to be pleasant, you drink three cocktails. By now, the day has lost its form and meaning. To try to restore some purpose and beauty to it, you drink too much at cocktails. You talk too much and make a pass at somebody's wife, and you end up doing something foolish and obscene and wish in the morning that you were dead. But when you try to trace back the way you came into this abyss, all you find is a grain of sand. John Cheever, journal entry, 1952. It is the speck that makes the cloud that wrecks the vessel, children, yet no one fears a speck. Emily Dickinson, 1871. Do you see how they kind of connect to each other? And the whole book is like that. It sort of leads you on this serpentine path because it's rarely ever a straight path where you put the drink down, go, I'm done, and you're done. I mean, if that happens, I'm sure it happens to some, and you're lucky. But a lot of times
talk about that some can. Comes to just shut it down. Okay, yeah, I'm done. Wow, that was a ride. I'm out. But a lot of people can. I mean, this is – when you talk about addiction, this is disease. This is something that's
it's the disease
you can't control.
Catches a lot of people because they go, well, you know, cancer's a disease. This is some voluntary thing you do. And there's a wonderful line by Seneca where he says, by disease, we mean a disorder in your mind where things that should have no or little value suddenly have tremendous value. And that's, to me, that even though it was written 2,000 years ago, it was a beautiful sort of description about what we're talking about. And so this is, a quote from William Burroughs, nobody decides to be a junkie. Okay, you just wake up in the morning and you're hooked. I mean, obviously there's that first thing, and you look at our society. I mean, once you become sober, you're kind of looking at those marshmallow flavored vodka ads on TV, and you think, really, who's supposed to drink that, and so a lot of society, and that's one of the many beautiful things about being sober, is you don't end up going to all those parties you used to go to just because you knew you could hang out at the bar. It makes you more selective about your life, where you do the things you really like, and you don't, you're not just sort of coasting along on a chain of lubrication.
Well, I mean, that's always been part of recovery, is trying to replace the behavior in some way that you feel good. And for you, I mean, obviously reading has been a huge part of your life. I mean, even before you were a columnist.
Oh, sure. I was a kid who was very bookish. I wasn't big into sports. I remember the guys showing up to play kickball and me kind of turning to my mother, sotto voce, and saying, Mom, the guys are here. I have to go out and play, but wait 20 minutes and call me back. I worried a bit that I'd written a book for myself that was of no interest to anybody else. And there is the risk of that. I'm not saying this is the universal solvent, throw this book in the rubber room with anybody and 3 hours later they're sober. Okay, you have to want to. And to me, the purpose of this is really was to gather these things together that I just found almost incredible. There's some quotes from Samuel Johnson, the great dictionary writer from 1750s, because if you read Boswell's Life of Johnson, he's having these deep conversations with Adam Smith, the economist, and Joshua Reynolds, the painter, who can't get their heads around the fact that he's not drinking. And so Joshua Reynolds says, now what if some good gentleman takes you into his cellar where he has this wine laid up 20 years and bids you drink? What do you do? And Johnson says, no gentleman will make another gentleman drink. And besides, once you've given up the enormous pleasure that comes from drinking wine, any other consideration is but a trifle. And I just love that.
That's
great. And,
yeah.
And Johnson has so much. You see him dug in. He says, I will be conquered. I will not capitulate. And just that thought, I will not surrender. I'm not going to give in. Some of these quotes are very simple. One's from Sarah McLachlan. She has a wonderful song called Fallen. And a lot of times you regret in sobriety. Oh, why did this happen? Why did I do this? Why am I have to cope with this? And she has a line that says, four words, better I should know.
Better I should know.
And you can't argue that, because it's true. When you have a situation that's true, you can say, yeah, I wish I could ignore this, and I wish I could blithely go about and uncork the wine and have the I have those feelings now all the time. It's a Sunday afternoon, we're in some shop and getting our lemonade and cheese. I'm thinking, Cabernet would go much better with that. And you have to sort of push those thoughts aside. And I talk about some
How do you do it? How do you do it? I mean, I know that that's such a simple question, but when you push those thoughts to the side, what are some of the mechanisms in which you can say, I can talk to myself?
I'll give you an easy one. We talk about it with our kids' consequences. I went to Japan for 8 days with my brother in March researching a story, and there would have been a time that would have been impossible. I'm on the other side of the world where I could do whatever I want, but I know that what happens in Japan doesn't stay in Japan. And I had the image of myself after 7 days of drinking in Japan, miserably riding that plane back home to Chicago, hungover and back into the whole thing again, and I just didn't want that to happen. So or there's something called meta-thinking, which I talk about in the book, where you step back and you have this great desire and you realize, well, if I wait for 20 minutes, it'll go away. And if I start drinking, it'll never go away because there's never enough. Okay, now there's a chapter on time. Time is hugely important in recovery because you have to do the right thing now and tomorrow and next week and next year, and you kind of have to master the big arc of your life. We quote the Irish Republican Army after they tried to blow up Margaret Thatcher.
Lucky, right.
And they say, you were lucky today, but you have to be lucky. We only have to be lucky once, and you have to be lucky every day. And I say in the book, no one's lucky every day. That's why luck is not going to do this. You sort of need a plan.
Neil Steinberg, the author of Out of the Wreck, I Rise, a literary companion to recovery. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll wrap up the convo. And then, I got to ask you about Union Station.
Of course.
You're going to be all over the news tonight.
The rubble, yes. Mr. News.
Rubble out of the wreck of Union Station. That's the story for tomorrow. Neil Steinberg, my guest at the big table tonight. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. My guest in studio, Neil Steinberg. He's the co-author of the book Out of the Wreck, I Rise, a literary companion to recovery, co-author with Sarah Bader. We're talking about literature, which has really developed a path. You call this a companion. It's not a guide. Yeah. But it really is, by seeing how so many different writers, esteemed writers, professional writers, legendary writers from throughout human time have talked about addiction and recovery, it becomes pretty evident and clear that this is not a new issue. And it's also an issue that, you know, a lot of creative, great minds have had to deal with in their lives.
Sure, the last chapter is called Gravy, and I quote the wonderful poem by Raymond Carver about the last 10 years of his life that he calls pure gravy, because he was supposed to die of drinking, and he didn't.
Right.
And he lived long enough to see himself hailed as a hero. And I mean, that's something, I mean, it's an argument. You know, what's heroic? Climbing a mountain, fighting in a battle. We just assume that. You don't have to argue that I'm a football hero and I won the game, but you know, why can't recovery be heroic? Why can't it be the path of the hero? Why can't you shed this destructive love? It's the thing you want most, but you're setting it aside for your family, for yourself, so you can go on living and enjoying. I mean, when you give up addiction, you're trading one thing for everything else in life, and you're so skewed by that addiction that you're not sure that's a good deal. You're like, the one thing I love versus everything else that I can do. And a lot of people, they make the wrong decision. And the part of the book is I'm trying to sort of goad people into trying this. Don't say you're doing this forever. I certainly never said that. But just take this journey. Try it. See where you end up.
Well, a lot of times you'll have people who are compulsive or are addicted or to whatever vice it is. They will try it when the stakes are high. Meaning, you know, they're going to get kicked out of their house.
Right.
They're
going you
have to do it. You mentioned that as one of the quotes. You know, you have to. But as it moves on, as time moves on, you know, your family regains trust. You mentioned this in the book.
That's when the danger comes up.
There's
a quote
in.
From Paul Molloy, the late Chicago columnist, where he says, wanting to give up drinking and wanting to get out of trouble are two different things. And that's very true. And if you're doing it, I mean, at first you do it just because you don't want to go to jail or you don't want to do anything. And then you have to find, if you don't find a way to do it for yourself, then you're going back. And people, I have people come to my signings, they've gone through rehab 4 times, 5 times, 6 times. Okay. And it as hard as it is the first time, it's even harder those next time. And to me, it's just when you look at the reality of it, it's so much better if you can stay on the path and if you can have Plato. I mean, the passage I have from the Republic, which you'd think is the highest brow thing, but he basically says, he's having a conversation, are there times when people want to drink and don't? And the guy says, yes, frequently they do. And he kind of says, well, what's the difference? And he says, part is these animal desires and lusts, and part is the mind, the intellect, which can take over and control these things. Now, certain people say, well, that's God, that's grace, that's different. What you call it doesn't really matter. What's important is that you somehow muster the strength to do it.
With writers, and you know, I was just talking off air about the idea that I remember I was with my friends in New York City and Manhattan, and we were in Greenwich Village, and we were at the White Horse Tavern, and that's where Dylan Thomas drank, and we were so excited about the romantic part of it, the idea that we're having gin and tonics, we're, you know, Dylan
we're adults.
And the bartender, I think, called it out, was like, this is not that's not a happy story. In the way that he was an alcoholic and, you know, he essentially pretty much died at the bar. The concept being that he rotted himself away. And you think about the romanticism around drinking and writing and writers. And it's prevalent in your business as columnists and Mike Royko. And
sure.
The idea that we're down at the Billy Goats, you know, we're all drunk together. I mean, is it tough to overcome
those?
Royko
was tough as an ox. He should have lived to be 90. Okay, I mean, it really killed him, and it made him unhappy. I mean, not to speak about a specific person, but people who give it up. I mean, John Cheever, I mean, some of these people are characters. You hear from them again and again. Cheever's one of them, a fabulous American fiction writer. And then you see him in his diaries talking about just how he's reduced to this, to the basest despair. And then we also quote the members of the family, Susan Cheever, talking about how he went into AA and he was just this bitter, unhappy man, and he came out 20 pounds lighter and was just a changed man. And so I really think that recovery can do wonderful things for people, but people just fight it at every turn because it feels the wrong thing. One chapter is called The Direction You Least Trust.
Right.
And that's exactly what recovery is. It's the one place you don't want to go, but
it's the
one place you need to go.
Well, don't people take part in those vices, whatever your vice is, because it's who they think they're at their best when they're drunk.
Again, I'm not anti all vices. It comes down to whether this is a choice. Can you have a glass of wine and then have a month go by and not care, or is it something where you wake up every day and that's what you're? And there's a line, I forget, from John Cheever where he has himself cutting wood and doing all sorts of stuff, but in the back of his mind he's thinking of that bottle of mash in the pantry, and as soon as he hears that noon bell go, he's like a shot there to pour it in. And it just, you sort of see him pretending like nothing's wrong. And he can't live his life like that.
Neil Steinberg is the author of Out of the Wreck I Rise, A Literary Companion to Recovery, talking about the book. Before I let you go, you are kind of a news story today.
Oh, God.
We might as well talk about it.
Better to be lucky than good sometimes, Justin.
Union Station today.
They're getting off the 837 Milwaukee North Line, and the woman behind me lets out a cry. She's hit by a 3-pound chunk of concrete that fell out, 30 feet from the ceiling, hit her on top of the head. And so I spent the day trying to find out who's responsible. And Metra said, well, Amtrak owns Union Station. And Amtrak says, well, the part that fell on her head is owned by someone else. And so here you have 500,000 people going through Union Station every day, and chunks of masonry are hitting people in the head. And because I took a picture, I actually went to take a picture of the masonry, and the woman was behind it. And so that's on the front page of the Chicago Sun-Times tomorrow. And I think I'm on every television station. This must be a slow news day is all I can think of.
Well, it's an interesting story about, I guess, if you really get into it, who is responsible.
Well, it's about bad priority. Again, it's like addiction is about bad priorities, because Amtrak is putting in shishi shops and first class lounges and things, and they should be paying for routine maintenance because obviously something's amiss.
And for you to be in that position, I mean, to be someone who helps the woman up and then realize you're right afterwards. That's really what it is.
You know, that's the thing. I was walking away and I thought, oh, wait a second, maybe I better go back. And I did. But then, one chunk hit two lawyers and Gray's the columnist. So, they got a lot of people going through Union Station, and I think Amtrak in the long run will wish, like other people with problems, Amtrak will wish they had taken care of the problem while it was small.
Neil Steinberg, columnist of Chicago Sun-Times. You can find that story in the paper tomorrow.
Front page, online now.
Neil, great to talk to you tonight.
Great to talk to you,
Thanks
Justin.
For sharing your story.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, tomorrow night, Millennium Park will be the place to see the stars. That's because it's the third annual Fifth Star Awards, a celebration of creativity put on by the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. This year's honorees include Buddy Guy, The Second City, Jackie Taylor, and others. But they won't be the only stars in attendance. The presenters are all A-list themselves. They include Cindy Crawford, Fred Willard, and my next guest, Chicago Blues star Shamika Copeland.
She won fair and square, and I hold no grudge. Why would you bring a new love around so soon? Why would you want her up, sword in my wound? Couldn't you wait till the my heart? Couldn't you wait till my bruised and battered pride, till it ain't torn apart?
Shamika Copeland is a treasure. She's won all sorts of awards, including the Best Contemporary Blues Female Artist of the Year, given by the Blues Music Awards. She's headlined at the Blues Fest. Her latest album on Alligator, Outskirts of Love, was a huge hit. Copeland will be presenting the Fifth Star Award to Chicago blues legend Buddy Guy. Shamika Copeland, welcome to the Download.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
How does it feel for you, I mean, as a blues musician, a young blues musician who's coming up to have success and be in a position where you get to present the Fifth Star Award to Buddy Guy?
Oh, my gosh. I'm so honored. I mean, Buddy Guy has been a complete treasure to so many blues artists. and artists that are not blues artists. So, I mean, you know, I can't think of anybody that plays guitar or does this particular genre of music that he's not been an influence for. So yeah. I'm honored to do it. Truly honored. Glad I get to be the one.
Yeah, right. What's your relationship like with Buddy Guy? What has he done for you and your music?
Oh my gosh. I mean, first of all, you know, it starts with being kind, because with new artists coming up in this business, you know, it's tough and it's hard. And he's always been very kind and genuine with me and to me. And I spent many a years touring with him. Some of my first tours were out on the road opening for Buddy Guy, you know, and he's done that for a lot of us.
Obviously, being a Chicago-based musician, being on Alligator Records, you spent a lot of time touring with Buddy Guy. What do we need to know about Buddy Guy, the person? You know, as Chicagoans, we all know him as a blues legend, but what do we need to know about him as a person?
Well, that's funny. I'm not sure I should say any of it, but I will anyhow, because you know what? I got the microphone. I would say things that people might not know about him is that he's very spiritual, and that's important in this business. He's a family man. He loves his family. He loves his kids. I mean, those are the things that I know about him.
What have you learned as a musician yourself from Buddy Guy? What about touring with him and going through your young career? What did you learn from playing with Buddy?
Well, you know, I think it's the same as from my father. There's ups and downs in this business, but you just have to keep on going. You know, you can't let that affect you. You just have to keep on going. Just pray that everything is going to be all right and just keep on moving no matter what happens.
We're talking with blues great Shamika Copeland, who will be introducing and presenting the Fifth Star Award to Chicago blues legend Buddy Guy tomorrow night. You've had such a great career. I mean, I remember having you on programs 10, 15 years ago when you were just starting out, 20 years. But talk about your career. Why don't we just start? I was amazed to see that, as you mentioned, your father, a blues man himself, Johnny Copeland, brought you on stage. Your first performance was at the age of 8. What do you remember about that?
I remember being in trouble, and it was Mother's Day, and I was supposed to be at home behaving myself, but I wasn't. And my mom came home and did the worst possible thing she could do to me at the time, which was put a dress on me and take me where my parents were, which was just a few blocks away at the Cotton Club. And we were celebrating Mother's Day there. And my father saw that she had went home and got me. And he started playing a song that we did around the house all the time. And I knew he was going to call me up. And I've never been more nervous in my entire life. And I thought, you know, I'm never getting in trouble again, because this is just torture. But it's funny, because looking back on the video, which I haven't seen now in, you know, 20 years or so, but looking back on the video, you could see me slowly getting into it, you know, people applauding. But, man, I was so nervous, and I thought, my parents, they must hate me. Why are they doing this to me, you know?
Well, your dad, Johnny Copeland, you know, when you turned 16, 17 years old, you started touring with him, you know, opening up but also being a part of the show. Talk about that experience to be able to be on tour with your father.
You know, it was awesome, because my father had always been a touring man. He had always been a traveling man, and we spent a lot of time on the phone together, you know, because he wasn't at home all the time. So being able to go out on the road with him the last couple years of his life, I was able to really spend some time, quality time, with my father, traveling a lot and getting to know him and learning who he is as an adult person, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. And, I guess I wasn't quite an adult, but I was a teenager, you know? So I got to learn things about my father that I'm not sure I would have otherwise got to learn if it had stayed the same way.
For you, I mean, being such a youngster, a teenager, as you mentioned, and being able to be thrust out onto stages on tour as a blues musician, what did that do for you in your career? I mean, did you learn quickly how to be a professional, how to find the discipline it takes to perform night after night on a blues stage?
Oh, absolutely. You learn fast. I went out on my first tour, and you learn quickly. You learn what you can do, what you can't do, how much sleep you need, how much water you should drink. You know, it really doesn't take that long, because your body tells you what you need to know, and I learn fast.
Do you keep those lessons that you learned as a teenager with you today when you tour?
Oh, abso-freaking-lutely. And let me tell you, as you get older, it only gets worse.
Right.
The less you can do. I mean, gosh, in my 20s, you know, I could be up 20 hours and still function normally. But now, if I don't get a full night's sleep, it's like, oh, my God, all hospital.
When you came out, I mean, a lot of the reviews and all of the accolades for you was just really about your powerful voice. Just a tremendous, tremendous voice on your debut album. And it continues to stick with you. But one of the things that I read you talking about was just that, you know, as you got older and more mature, you become less reliant on that voice, that you've turned yourself into more of an evolved musician, whether it be for writing the songs, performing the songs. You're not just relying on the power of that voice.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. Working with different producers and different types of artists, it's been great for me because, you know, you learn that you can still move people, just like all the artists that I listen to. You know, you don't have to belt out every song to move your audience. And it took me time to learn that. You know what I'm saying? Because I came from that school, that old school, you know, that's what you do. And I just never thought I had the type of voice that could move people without the belting, you know?
Right.
You know, you get older, you build up your confidence, and you get comfortable in your own skin, and you learn that you can be powerful in different ways, you know?
We're talking with Chicago blues great Shamika Copeland, who will be presenting another Chicago blues great, a legend, Buddy Guy, tomorrow at the 5th Star Awards, put on by the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, which is at Millennium Park. It'll be tomorrow night at Millennium Park. It's been a huge celebration there. I'm interested because, you know, I've had blues musicians on the show, and we've talked about the idea of not only being a blues performer and performing the blues, but living the blues. As you talk about writing songs, writing the blues, how much of the music comes from your personal story, and how much of it is music that is really just more reflection of current events and the times?
A lot of it these days is current events and times, because that's kind of what I've been focusing on here lately in the latest records. But, you know, people definitely had rougher lives back in the day, you know, and they definitely were able to sing about them, those lives. But it's not fair for me to do that because my life really was never that rough. I mean, I can only speak of it for me. Mm-hmm. I don't think my life was as rough as my mother's life. I never had to pick cotton or work on somebody else's farm, you know, anything like that. But for me, my life was difficult because of where I grew up and the dangers of it, and watching a lot of my friends get killed and stuff in my neighborhood and things like that. So it was difficult in that way. But we got out of that neighborhood and things got better. And so, you know, earlier on, I talked about those things in my music. Nowadays, it's more about current events, you know. I'm talking about date rape and domestic violence and religious hypocrites and political hypocrites. And, you know, those are the things that I'm interested in talking about these days. And boy, I'm telling you, it gets more and more. I'm going to have to make a new record coming up here real soon.
That is a endless, yeah, an endless well of material there. I'm interested, but, you know, as, you know, I mean, you talked about your life, your upbringing, you know, it is a different generation. And different blues musicians who are coming up now are going to have different experiences from their elders. But as you mentioned, I mean, having friends who are no longer with you, having a situation where you have to get out of a neighborhood, that may not be the same story as your father or your mother, but it is a story that is important and part of the blues as well.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. But, you know, just like I don't want to sing a whole lot of love songs, you know, I don't want to keep singing about those same things. So yeah. I just try to switch it up a little bit, you know.
You know, you've had such great success here in Chicago. You were born in New York or you spent time in Harlem, but you've really been known as a Chicago-based musician. What does that mean to you to be a Chicago-based blues musician?
Oh, so much. I mean, I love the city of Chicago so much. And the best thing I ever could have done was move here because it's been so good to me. And, you know, I just feel like this is where I belong. You know, this is where I needed to be all along. And it just makes me very happy that I found the home that I was always meant for.
You know, the blues music, not unlike jazz, has seen less record sales and less, I would say, less contributions and less participation as well. What do you think that, where do you think that comes from, the idea that, you know, we're seeing less and less blues music in the mainstream than we have, you know, in decades past?
You know, we're seeing less and less good music in general. And that's just, you know, when things become corporate, you know, corporate gets involved in the music business, things change, you know, and that's what's wrong with pretty much everything in this country, politics and all of it. You know, there's only a few people that control it. That's never good. It's a shame, but eventually people always get back to the good stuff. You know, no one will ever stop listening to Motown and Stax, you know, but eventually, you know, I think what happens is that people come back to the good stuff. You know, they don't have another choice.
Well, that good stuff will be on display at Millennium Park tomorrow night as part of the Fifth Star Awards presented by the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs. Shamika Copeland will be presenting the Fifth Star Award to Chicago blues legend Buddy Guy. Shamika Copeland, thanks so much for taking some time out. And next time you come through, I'd love to have you in studio. We'd love to talk more. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
So excited. Fred Willard coming up after the break. How great is that, Pete? I feel as giddy. It's sometimes, you know, you do the interviews, you're sort of a fanboy. I felt the same way. Remember when Gary Cole was on? It's like, Gary Cole's on. We got so excited when he called in. Fred Willard tonight. It's so fun because I put it up on Facebook that he was coming on the show and all these people doing quotes. And to think, and the line I love is to think that they eat dogs in some countries. He's the announcer at the Best in Show. Or in Spinal Tap when he's talking about, I don't want to get too close to the band. You know, it's been a while since I got a haircut. They might think I'm part of the band. No, I'm joking, of course. And you know, the other thing I was doing the research, Fernwood Tonight. He was Martin Mull's right-hand man on Fernwood Tonight. He's had such an amazing career, a career that really formed back in 1965 at the Second City. And that is what he is going to be in town tomorrow for. He is going to be presenting the Fifth Star Award to the Second City at Millennium Park. Fred Willard, the man presenting the award to Second City. That's amazing. Fred Willard will join us after the news here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're going to play The Worst. This, of course, where we complain about the worst things in our society for prizes. We've got good prizes tonight, so we'll give it away. We'll have some comedians in studio. 312-981-7200 is the number to call and participate tonight coming up at 10 o'clock. Well, my next guest is one of the greats. Fred Willard has been involved in so many memorable films and television programs that it's hard to list them all. I mean, I guess we'll start with Fernwood Tonight, one of the best programs of all time. Also, Willard has always had a home with filmmaker and comedian Christopher Guest and has appeared in movies like This is Spinal Tap, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, and the upcoming film Mascots, which will be out in October, just to name a few. But did you know that Willard cut his teeth in comedy at the Second City right here in Chicago? His first main stage show was back in 1965. Willard will be back on stage in Chicago at Millennium Park tomorrow night to present the Second City with a Fifth Star Award put on by the Department of Cultural Affairs. And it is my pleasure to welcome legend Fred Willard to The Download tonight. Mr. Willard, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm great. How does it feel to be the one that gets to present the award to the Second City back here in Chicago?
All kidding aside, it's very flattering when they call. I mean, there's such a group of great alumni from Second City, and I've always been a very big fan of Second City. I've always come to see their shows. They've put me in a lot of shows, and so it's a great honor, really a great thing, and for the whole city of Chicago, you know, it's just a great thing. I love Chicago. I'm not from Chicago. I'm from Cleveland, but I spent a lot of time here.
Well, let's talk about that time. You know, as I mentioned, your first main stage show that is documented is 1965. Talk about coming to Chicago. What are your memories of of being a young comedian coming to Chicago to work with Second City?
Well, I was very familiar with their Second City's work, and I'd been to Chicago. I had a partner working in, we worked in clubs, the old Mr. Kelly's here in Chicago,
right.
Gatorhorn, and I auditioned, and they asked me to come, and at first I didn't want to come because I was going to be a Broadway star, you know, in New York, but I came for 6 months and stayed an extra 6 months, and it was probably the most, really one of the best years of my life artistically, because at Second City, you can do something during the day, have an idea, and have it up on stage that night.
Yeah.
With a great cast of characters. I was in the same company with Robert Klein, David Steinberg, a wonderful girl named Judy Grobart, and a very funny English lady named Sandra Caron. And so we had a great repertory company and just had a lot of fun. So for here, just for laughs and having fun, it was wonderful.
For you, I mean, to be already in comedy and have a partner work in clubs like Mr. Kelly's, what did Second City teach you about improv, about some of the things that later on in your career you became, you know, famous for?
Well, at the time, back then, there wasn't, improv was not that big a thing like it is today, where they have rules and books written about it.
Right.
I think what comes, like anything, is just actually doing it. Be put out on the stage. I was, we opened the show with a set material, and I remember the first time they actually almost had to push me out on stage into a scene, and I went out with nothing on my mind and did very well. And the next night, a scene was going on. I had a great joke. And I came out and I did the joke and I was left with nothing. So I think that's one thing I learned. Don't go out with one joke on your mind and think that's going to carry you. So just like jump in a canoe and go downstream with everyone. That's what we learned. And at the end of the year or even 6 months, you realize you can get on a stage with nothing prepared and just, if not be great, at least hold your own and keep a scene moving. So that's what it is. Like anything, just experience. Yeah.
Well, for you, I mean, You've
working
been
with people like David Steinberg and Robert Klein, who then was known as Bob Klein. This is before he did his great stand-up stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was a very supportive group.
For you, I mean, it's interesting because you learned all these techniques at a time when improv wasn't the sort of, you know, the standard necessarily. Like you mentioned, books and other things have been written since, and it's become sort of a cottage industry. But when you were on stage in the 60s at Second City, it was just part of a means to an end. That was, you know, the almost what you guys would do to get ready to be able to put the stuff on stage. But you have made a career out of being in films with Christopher Guest, where improv is a big part of it, where that's, you know, some of the legendary films that we know in this country come out of, you know, a premise and you guys being able to play with it. I mean, talk about how, you know, you came from cutting your teeth at Second City and you're able to, in your career, have a career where improv is a big part of it.
Yes. Well, working again with Christopher Guest, again, it kind of made me nervous because I said, geez, I'm going to have to write all these lines. But you're, again, working with a whole group of people that you admire and have faith in. Bob Balaban, Eugene Levy, Catherine O'Hara. And you just jump in and rather than just try to, you know, score bigs, like there's a difference with doing improv in a nightclub or on an improv show where you try to get big laughs. In a Christopher Guest movie, you try to just keep the scene going, mm-hmm. try to make it humorous. You go in with a humorous slant, but keep the whole scene moving. Kind of know in the back of your mind that he's filming 120 hours that's going to be cut down to 85 minutes. So if you have a thought, just say it and do it. And as they say, as one of the lessons of improv, yes, and, which I never understood, but what it means is if someone comes in and with a premise, you just jump on board and go with
it. You sound
stop them. What's that you said?
I said you sound somewhat like your character from Waiting for Guffman. When you need a line, you just come up with when you have a line, just say it. But that there is something to that.
If you forget your lines, yeah, just start talking about your day. Think about your day. Yeah.
For
you, know,
you,
in a way, I think you just have to kind of think funny. I I was taking good things and bad things in my life with kind of a funny in the back of my mind that there's laughs underneath it. So you kind of go along with that, and you're supported by, as I say, great people who you know aren't going to undermine you. And so it's, but I've always been a great fan of Second City, even before I was in Second City. I remember once flying from Las Vegas to New York and spending a night in Chicago just to see the Second City company. And since then, since I've worked in Second City. We come to Chicago the first night, let's go to Second City. If we've seen the show, we go around back, go into the ETC show and see that. It's always such good stuff. They're always so bright. They never play down to an audience. They make the audience kind of come up to their level. Even if a lot of times you don't get what they're talking about, you still laugh. And I remember that when I first saw the original company with Alan Arkin and Barbara Harris and Severin Darden. There are a lot of things that would go over my head, but you still laughed. You got the humor that they were trying to get across.
Yeah, right.
Doing philosophical things and historical things and political things, but they made it very funny.
For you, I mean, is it exciting? I mean, you say that you come to Chicago and you go to find the the theater. You go to Second City. You go to Second City ETC all around the corner. I mean, do you find yourself gravitating towards the stage? I mean, thinking about the times when you were on that exact stage, main stage. Thinking about your time, Mr. Kelly, getting back to the stage.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I was in different comedy groups. We played many places here in Chicago, and you have memories of being on the stage until they come out at intermission and say, Fred, would you like to get up in the set with us?
Right.
And say, and my wife always says, go on, get up. I say, but they make it quite easy for, you have a thing where you can pop in and out of a scene. But it's still a little scary because it's like, going to a Cubs game and having them come out and say, would you like to come up and play the last three innings with us? Yeah, I'd love to, but I'm going to feel like a fool.
We're talking with Fred Willard. Fred Willard, of course, is the comedy legend. He's going to be presenting the Fifth Star Award to the Second City tomorrow, Millennium Park, which is a great honor for the Second City. It's put on by the Department of Cultural Affairs, celebrates creativity. And Fred Willard spent time, as an ensemble member, as you mentioned, some of the people that you've mentioned about coming to see Alan Arkin, coming to be a part of the stage, and even, the movies with Christopher Guest. You have found a way to have a career in ensemble. How important is it to have an ensemble around you and to be able to have history with the people you're performing with?
Well, it's very important. It's very supportive. I've tried to do stand-up, which is very rewarding, even if you're not good at it. It can be, a lot of young people say to me, what's the best way to get started? And I'll say, come up with 4 or 5 minutes. Even if it's not funny, get up someplace. You don't have to kill the crowd. Someone might, develop. But it's very tough, and it's much easier when you have an ensemble of other people that kind of inspire you. And so I always tell people, come up with 5 minutes on your own. If you can't do that, get into an improv group. Get into a sketch group. Get some friends at school. Put together, write some sketches. They don't have to be, world beaters. You just get up and start doing things. And go to classes. Go to an acting class. Go and take improv classes. An improv class may not teach you anything, but what they will teach you, they'll put you up with opposite someone and say, okay, you're on a ship that's sinking, and your wife took the last seat in the boat, and, go. You got a first line. How could you have done this to me? You'll fail many times, but you'll get a background. It's like anything that way. And if you don't succeed at it, there's a million other things to do.
Yeah, right.
It's like playing a banjo. You can be the best banjo player in the world, but if you can't, what does that mean? And if you can't play the banjo, go on to do something else.
Absolutely. For you, I mean, you've had comedy in your blood from like you mentioned, the Mr. Kelly days, the Second City, to getting in the television. Fernwood Tonight was just genius. and all the work that you've done in sitcoms as well as movies, including the Christopher Guest canon, you know, how important is it for you? I mean, at what point was there ever a point where you came to that thought where you're like, you know what, I don't know if I want to be a comedian. I don't know if this is I'm cut out for this. Maybe I'll try something else. Or has it always been comedian or die?
Well, just lately I've been thinking that. I've been saying, maybe I wasn't right for this business. So you watch a TV show and say, this is the worst piece of crap I've ever seen. And the next thing you read in the papers, it came in number two in the whole country. I said, well, maybe this isn't my business. But one thing, I've never had anything I could fall back on. And that's a good thing. I guess my fallback would be just be in the park with pushing a cart around. That wouldn't be so bad. I'm serious. If my dad owned a sporting goods store and said, come on in, which I did, I had a stepfather who wanted me to take over his clothing business. I never once thought about it. Yeah, that might be pretty good, selling, retail clothes in Cleveland, Ohio. I didn't want to do that. So, but that would be wonderful for some people who might say, God, I can't believe you'd get up, do eight shows a week, the same show every night. What do you do? I've had people say to me, what do you do when you're not working? Do you just sit around all day? And I said, well, I guess so. But every day, who has security in this life?
Right.
Who knows a year from now they're going to be working the same job other than you? I mean, I hear great things about you. So, I mean, you're safe. You're safe.
Right.
If
thank
not,
you.
Job, another thing. And what are you doing in Chicago? New York is your next step.
That's why I got to get to New York.
You know
right.
what I mean? It's, who can say a year from now I'll be where I am or better? So there's no security in anything. But just keep going. A lot of my success has been I found things that I love, like SCTV, the SCTV show.
Yeah, absolutely.
I got to know those people, and I loved them. I took a love to Second City. I'm a big fan of Eugene Levy. Christopher Guest, I love. And you get in with that crowd. I guess if I'd gotten into very close with John Voight and those people, I might be doing a dramatic TV show now. But so find out what you really like and just immerse yourself in it.
Well, I would say that Christopher Guest, the Eugene Levy, they got in with you, with Fred Willard. They found the right guy to get in with.
Wait, I'm writing this down. Because, damn it. Well, I don't get the credit I deserve. This Eugene Levy. And I was in one of those movies he did, the
American Pie.
Right.
And then my wife was, she said, oh, you shouldn't do that. I said, yeah, but, Eugene, I read that he got seven figures for doing 3 days and one that went straight to video. I said, wait, seven figures. But he's worth it, I'll tell you.
All right,
makes me laugh.
Let me ask you one last question. I'll let you go.
I'm very busy. I'm sitting in the park, the white the Water Tower Park, writing. Oh,
all right.
Thank you very much, sir. Someone just dropped 25 cents in my coffee cup.
Fred Willard, my guest tonight.
Who says there's no love in Chicago?
Yeah, right? They love you here. We love you in Chicago. All right, so tomorrow night you'll be on stage at Millennium Park introducing Second City, presenting them with the fifth star award, a big award. For you, thinking about your career, I mean, the 1965, that's 50 years, to think about your time on stage. I mean, when you think back on that time, do you consider yourself a Second City guy at heart? Are you always Second City through and through? I mean, for all the experience you've
had? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, people ask me. Now there's so many different groups. There's Upright Citizens Brigade. There's the Groundlings. I still, they're all great. But I'm still a big fan of Second City. And as for tomorrow night, the Second City Trooper is going to do about 10 minutes. The Black Ensemble Theater is going to do a few minutes, and someone just told me that they're doing the life story of Jackie Wilson.
Yeah.
I'm such a fan of him. I hope they do a little bit of Jackie Wilson, and it's going to be a great night. I'm really looking for Buddy Guy. Yeah, the whole it's going to be a great night under the stars.
Cindy
hopefully.
Crawford.
There you go. Right. Cindy Crawford. Fred Willard, a pleasure to talk to you. Good luck tomorrow night, but always great to have a chance to listen to you and to check out your work on stage and screen. Fred Willard, go ahead.
I really enjoyed this. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. Fred Willard will be introducing the Fifth Star Award at Millennium Park tomorrow for Second City. All right. How about that, huh? Fred Willard on the show. You can't get any better than that. That's awesome. And it's great that he had somebody there laughing along with him, too. And he's sitting in the park. He's sitting. The best part about it is he's only 4 or 5 blocks away. So great, man. So great to have Fred Willard on the program. And for him to be, I enjoyed that interview. I don't know about you, but the idea that he was pretty loose and open and talking about life and having laughs in a park.
Hilarious.
That's so good, man. Just a couple of blocks from the studio. That's one of these days we'll be able to communicate. Be like, it's 3 blocks. You can come in. It's nice. There's air conditioning. Sometimes we got to call the boiler room, but. All right, coming up on the worst. Yes, 312-981-7200. You know what's the worst, Pete? When the cashier asks you if you want 5%, are you interested in 5% off of your thing today? You are interested in 10% off? You're interested in 15% off?
Yeah, who would
yeah,
be?
Yeah, yeah. Well, would you like to sign up for the... every time. No, it's not even a trick anymore. It's every single cashier. Every single store. If it's the grocery store, if it's the Gap, if it's... whatever it is, it's like, are you interested in 5% off today? Oh, this is a great question. yeah. Would you like to sign up for a credit card that you'll never be able to get rid of? Yeah. That's all I got to do? Next time I go in a store, that's what I'm going to do. What? Oh, yeah. This is the greatest day ever. You just totally flip out. Really fun. I hate that. That's the worst.
Oh.
Okay, I made the deal. I bought the clothes. Don't upsell me or change the deal at the register.
Well, they want you to buy more clothes down the line.
Right.
You know, get your email. Next thing you know, I recently did a purge on all my, you know, 100 Gap emails that I get, Old Navy. It was really nice.
Do you give your email? That's an old thing, too, right? Can I get your email? No. Are we friends? Next time someone asks me, can I get your email? Be like, yeah, can I get your number? And see how they like it, right?
Don't you want to save money?
Let's do a little role playing. You be the cashier, Esmeralda, and be like, hello, yeah, I just want to buy these 4 things.
Can I get your email address?
What do you need my email address for? That's kind of weird. That's kind of personal.
Well, we send you coupons and discounts.
Oh, yeah?
And tell you about sales that we have. And we don't sell your information.
Will you send me directions to the party? You guys having a party?
Party's right here, man.
I could tell by the cool techno you guys are jamming. All right, there we go. That was role play. All right, coming up, the worst.
Bravo.
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 Thanks, Rob. Thank you.
Well done.
It's the players. It's the download players.
It's going down, y'all. Come the worst, my people come first.
All right, thanks, Rob. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for the worst. This, of course, the segment where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. And then there are good prizes tonight. We're giving away a pair of tickets to the sold-out Chicago Blackhawks Training Camp Festival, which is coming up Saturday, September 24th, inside the United Center. We've also got tickets to theater. I've also got a pizza to give away. There's a lot to give away tonight. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number. You can text or you can call into that line. And I've got some great people in studio tonight to help us. Merritt Landsteiner is a stand-up comedian. Merritt,
hello.
Thanks for being here. Good to see
thanks
you.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
She is a producer at 10 at the Store, comedy showcase, first and third Thursdays at the Store Bar in Lincoln Park. It's this Thursday at 9:30.
Nine
o'clock.
Yeah, coming this Thursday, Danny Callis headlines. It'll be a great show. Free show.
There you go. Free comedy show. That's coming up here on the 15th. Merritt here to play the worst. Also, regular for the downloads, the worst, Mars Timms. What's up, Mars? How are you?
What's up, Jess?
All right. So Mars, of course, is the man behind Pimprov, which you can see every Friday. It's at the Chemically Imbalanced Theater, which is CIC at 1422 West Irving Park. You can also check him out. He's going to be at the Improv in Schaumburg in October, opening for Whitney Cummings.
Yep.
And also a new show on Netflix called Easy, which I'm going to hear about. I got to hear about this.
Oh, yeah. It's a cool show. It's Joe Swanberg, a lot of Chicago people in there, TJ Jagodowski, Hannibal Buress, Orlando Bloom from Lord of the Rings.
No big deal.
You know. Every girl in their 20s and 30s knows who that is.
Oh, okay. Well, ladies. check that
and
out.
And also, you're in this issue, the quarterly issue of Men's Magazine, which is why you, if you're watching the webcam tonight, you could see a dressed up Mars Timms. He looks good.
Yes, that's right. I look like I should be parking cars and giving out bean pies right here. So
it's a good combo. It's a good combo. It looks
it's
good.
A good combo.
Mars Timms, and also special guest tonight. This is a huge, huge honor.
It's a greater honor for me.
Greg Holloman in studio. Greg, also with Pimprov. He's a longtime comedian who was also the star of Strangers with Candy on Comedy Central.
Yes.
Back in the day, one of the greatest shows ever produced.
Ever.
And it's great to have you here, too, Greg. Thanks
Thank
for being
you, Justin.
Here.
You picked me up off the street. I'm taking a picture outside the window.
I love this town, man. I love this town. I could be talking on the phone with Fred Willard and look out the left, and there's Principal Blackman. And it's like, here we go. Let's do it. So let's have some fun tonight. 312-981-7200. Of course, we start the worst the way we started every week with Pete Zimmerman. Pete!
Hey, Justin.
Hey, Pete.
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
Coughing.
Coughing.
Not only yourself, but when other people are near you coughing.
There's nothing worse. If you make that a public cough, if you say public coughing, that's like when you feel like it's World War Z's coming on and you're in the wrong spot.
It's the worst.
It's the worst. That is a good start. But coughing and public coughing in general. Yep. Yeah, I agree. It's so funny, too, because in the radio studio here, we have a cough button.
Mm-hmm.
And every person who comes in goes, oh, cough button. What's this? It makes me cough. and then you explain that it's to mute the mic. And so everybody, I feel like coughing has become, like, that's a thing that the
Wait,
word.
So there's a button you press.
Yeah, right there.
Look right in front of you, Greg.
Really?
Wait, he still doesn't see it. He's looking. Ladies and gentlemen, he's looking. Get your cheater
it's in
glasses
between on. And off.
I don't see it.
We'll find it for you, Greg.
Greg's from Chicago Public Schools. He doesn't read that well.
Yeah, but you're from Chicago Public Schools on the west side. You spell it with a K.
That's the street version.
That is the street version. All right, Merritt, so why don't we start with you? Okay. All right, what's the worst, Merritt?
Okay, well, yes, I do stand up at night, but I do have a boring office job. And I think for anyone who works in the office, the worst is when you're walking to the bathroom at the same time as your coworker.
Oh, yeah.
And then you both enter the stall at the same time, and it's like, who's going to make the pee noise first? Or worse, if you have to do something else.
I bail.
I hate that.
I bail.
Oh, my
God. You just pretend you're going to the stairwell?
Yep.
Yeah.
I go walk right
past. I do that sometimes, but it's just the worst. I hate it, and I hate the small talk in general. I hate it.
Yeah. Well, I think for guys, there's no doubt that you'll bail. If you see two making a beeline for the same bathroom, you're like, you know what? I'm going to pretend like I'm just checking out this painting. Mm-hmm. And I'll wait 10 minutes. I'll come back.
Wait, hold on a second. You guys talk in between stalls?
Well, I went like walking down the hallway to the bathroom.
Like
but yes, some women will hold conversation between stalls, and I hate when they do that too.
Oh my god! Yeah.
Well, it's like if
we're
it's
not
like
supposed to know that
your best friend. That's but it's like my coworkers. Ugh, no.
Yeah.
No.
And then there's other. My office is like three different offices share a big bathroom, so it's like then there's people in there you don't even know.
You don't even know, right?
It's so awkward. I hate it.
We have one bathroom down here. That's just one toilet. And it's so weird, and there's this weird kind of code where if the door shuts, somebody's in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you will be in a position where you're like, I really have to go, and if somebody accidentally shut the door and nobody's in there, you don't knock, you just think someone's in there, and you just forego going to the bathroom. Cause, it's like the code down here.
And you don't have much time in between.
Yeah, right, exactly. You have to make decisions quick. All right, Mars, what's the worst?
The worst is when you have a dog that is more fearful than you.
Oh, man. I hate fearful dogs.
I hate fearful. I was just walking from this event, and I'm fearful myself. It's like, all right, there's a white woman. It's dark outside. I don't want to get too close to her. But she had a dog, and her dog freaked out because I was walking up behind
like
her.
Like freaked out, like barking?
It didn't even bark. Like, it cowered and like jumped to her. And she was like, oh, it's all right. And it's like, You have a dog. Your dog is your protection.
Yeah, the dog should be a little bit more stoic.
Yeah, I would be fine if the dog was like, bah, 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 bah. I'm like, good job. Good job. There's somebody walking up. It's dark. Good job. But when your dog cowers, that's the worst because you have no protection.
There you go. All right, 312-981-7200. We're already getting some great stuff in. We will take a quick break. We'll come back. Greg Holloman, Mars Timms, Merritt Landsteiner. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Landsteiner and Pete Zimmer. Everybody's here. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. 312-981-7200. Welcome back to Download. It's the Worst here. 312-981-7200. We got a lot of great calls and texts that are coming in and great people in studio. Mars Timms. Of course, he's a regular here at the Download. Merritt Landsteiner, comedian and producer here in Chicago. And Greg Holloman, a TV star. We got TV stars all over the place. Yeah. Now we got Mars Timms as a TV star with this with Easy, with Joe Swanberg's show. And you're also going to be in Shrink, which is Tim Vault's show on CISO, which is coming up, which is awesome.
Yeah,
we got a lot going on. We'll talk about all that stuff coming up a little bit later. Let's get right back to the worst. Why don't we go to Alan? Alan, what's the worst, buddy?
You know what the worst is? Cashiers that want to talk to you about food that you're buying at the counter. Hey, wow, you feel like chips tonight? I see you're into some ice cream. Yeah, self-loathing isn't enough. I really want something from you, too. This is great. Let's talk about it all.
Thanks, Alan. That's good. I like that. It's so true. Yeah. Appreciate that. That's what isn't that the Kristen Wiig Target bit?
Target lady.
She's like making fun of. Yeah, that kind of concept.
That got her on SNL, that character. She thought of that at Groundlings. I just listened to an interview with her.
Really? That was the one, huh?
Well, that was one of them, yeah.
All right, there you
Weren't
go.
Weren't you a cashier at some point, Justin?
I was. Thank you, Mars, for bringing that up. Nice. I was a cashier at Omni Superstores, which was the superstore push in the 90s. For Dominick's, when Dominick's, you know, when everything was bigger.
Yeah.
Right. You know, like they had the Super Jewels and the Super Dominick's, you know, it's kind of a precursor to Costco.
I remember Omni's, but I remember Omni too.
It's gone now, but don't look for it. It's not there anymore. But my MO as a cashier is I was good. I was kind of like a Tom Cruise cocktail kind of guy. Like I could move the stuff, I could throw the stuff up. I was like a show.
Oh, wow.
So I had regular customers who'd want to go. I had a line going three deep, you know, and nobody in the other ones because they wanted a little piece of it. Yeah. At least that's how I remember it.
Oh, yeah, that's how I got remember it.
They're calling over the loudspeaker to open up more lines. I'll open on number two.
Nobody wanted
like,
nobody.
Nope.
No.
We're here for Justin.
That's right. All right, let's go to Sue. Sue, what's the worst, Sue?
Hi, good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
You know, thank you. I could be in Walmart or Target or the Jewel, whatever, grocery store, any store, and the family or the little kids, they just are letting them run around and they knock the toys off the shelves and bounce the balls around or are running with the cart. I mean, I've almost hit little kids with my cart because all of a sudden they run out of the aisle.
Yeah, that's
and then
good.
the parent looks at you like, what?
Yeah, I agree, Sue. I will say that I agree with you on this one as someone who has a small child, but also somebody who can't go down an aisle at the Target where like some of the sports equipment's at without picking up a ball and starting to throw it around. Like I actually encourage it, and I apologize to
this
throwing
one.
Footballs and basketballs. I'm a chaos.
I have seen Mars Timms ride a bike.
I rode a big wheel, a green machine. I always wanted one as a kid, and I was in.
Well,
a
let
Walmart.
Me know where you're going to be next time.
All right,
watch Thanks, your Sue. Ankles. Yeah, I rode a green machine in a Walmart, like just through
the
up and down the
39-year-old man riding a green machine. I'm like, what the hell?
Man, those floors are great for doing those like spin outs like in the old commercial.
Right. 312 has a good cashier one. The cashiers who don't know how to handle cash. And it's true. You get that now because it's all cards and it's all computerized that if you actually pay with cash, like they're not quick to be like, $12.42. They don't know how. They're not using the right thumb. Mm-hmm. They're not. You know, they're not moving fast. They're not using both.
They
hands.
Hate me then because I'm all cash.
You're all cash.
No cards.
That's that Strangers with Candy money.
That's it.
I got 20th century money.
Let's go to Teresa. Teresa. What's the worst, Teresa?
All right. The worst I have to say is several years ago I had gotten my first cell phone, and I didn't know how come I kept getting messages on my cell phone, but it would never ring. So I called up the cell phone company and asked them what the problem was. And the first thing they said to me is, do you have your cell phone turned on? I didn't know you had to turn the cell phone on. All right, don't laugh.
The worst is when you don't know when to turn your cell phone on.
Oh, man. The worst is
That's terrible, Teresa.
Being old with a cell phone.
But I will say this, that in the early days of cell phones, I think that was probably a big complaint, was trying to figure out how you do it. So I wouldn't beat yourself up about it, just the way that it is. But
okay.
All right, there you go.
It was nice talking to you,
Thanks,
too.
Teresa.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. There you go. I mean, hey. I mean, I should have got the date on that if she was like, this was 2 weeks ago. But it sounded like it was a while back, right?
Well, that must have really bothered her.
Yeah, it really bothered her.
15 years later, that's the worst.
It happens. Greg's like 80, and he still calls me to like get his cell phone to work.
Can I beat him with your microphone? Just
yes, we have a news break coming up. You can do whatever you want with
God bless you. Thank you.
All right. Let's continue on. I've got some great stuff. 708 says the worst is when Justin's line was too long. Thank you.
Call back.
Oh, I think we got a winner right here. 705 says, you know what's the worst? Goatees.
Oh, agreed. Seriously. As the woman on the panel, I don't like them.
That's a really good one. I think that might. That's
I like that one. Yeah.
Even worse is the little tiny patch thing they do
the
down
soul
here.
Patch.
That's the only thing I grow.
You're a goatee guy? Oh, I don't know, man. I've seen pictures of me with goatees, and I was like, what am I thinking?
Yeah,
but it was always when I was single.
Oh.
You know what I mean? I don't think I ever went through any phase when I was with somebody where I'm like, oh, let me sculpt this.
That's kind of like the bad boy look, right? Yeah. Isn't it, that goatee?
You just have to have it sculpted well. If it's sculpted well, it looks good. You know.
I know, but I have
you
some people.
You tell yourself that.
It's true. Well, you
listen to the
people.
Woman in the room. Yeah,
listen to the woman.
Yeah,
it's no good. No good.
There it is.
Have you seen sculpted ones and non-sculpted ones?
I don't care.
See, she doesn't care. See,
it's all bad.
Well, there's a sculpted one makes you look like you're in Color Me Bad, and that's never a good look.
I wasn't thinking exactly that.
When you get to like that Backstreet Boys Color Me Bad kind of look, when you're sculpting like you're Eddie and Jobo, that's not where you want to be, right? Right.
Yeah, look at these
guys. 312-981-7200 is the phone number to call. I like that one a lot. Before we go to the break, let's get a couple more in here. 708 says photo enforced tickets. The worst.
Yeah.
It is, man.
I've gotten one of those red light tickets.
I've gotten a few of those myself.
I feel like you all are going to get your money back. Because the government has pushback and every little detail, and a judge has sent, like, red light tickets right now are they're not giving them out anymore because they just, the whole thing is up in the air because they didn't do process. There's a lot of stories. It's so funny to see how the legal system helps people when a lawyer gets a photo enforced ticket, you know?
Like, that's essentially it. When a judge is like, I got a photo enforced ticket. Yeah.
So I don't know if that's going to be a thing moving forward, but something tells me everything's going to be robots, so. Probably.
It will be. Yeah. You know, my thing is, my peeve is...
What's the worst, Greg?
The worst is all the other lines on the CTA trains not feeling like the Brown Line. I was in Florida for a month. I've been in Florida for a year, and I came back like 3 weeks ago, and I got on a red line and everything, and then I got on a red line and everything was peaceful.
Oh, the Brown Line,
cool. People are playing chess, and I'm like, "What the hell?" So
the Brown Line has always been that the air conditioning works.
They need to make
it doesn't smell like that weird fire smell. Like that doesn't come from the Brown Line. You're
every
right.
train needs to. That's what the CTA needs. Everything needs to feel like the Brown Line.
That should be their new slogan, right?
Everything. Look, I'm a Green Line rider. I'm a West Side person. If I don't have that fear in my heart when I get on the train, it just doesn't feel right.
Merritt Landsteiner, Mars Timms, Greg Holloman in studio tonight. We're playing the worst. 312-981-7200. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get the update on tonight's news, and we will be back. Stay with us.
It's going down, y'all.
Thanks, Rob. It's the download here. It's the worst. 312-981-7200. We're playing the worst here, complaining about the worst things in society for prizes. Yeah. Yeah, that's Greg Holloman. You may know him from being a part of Pimprov, which you can see Friday nights at the CIC. Also, he's in the new show Shrink, which is on CISO, and of course, stars Strangers with Candy.
Yeah,
a great show that was on Comedy Central, which is crazy to think almost 20 years ago. That's crazy.
It is crazy,
right?
Yeah, I don't want to think of 20 years later.
That's how I met Greg Holloman.
There you go. Mars Timms, another man behind Pimprov, but also you can see him at the Improv in October, opening for Whitney Cummings. You can also see him on the new Netflix show, Easy, Joe Swanberg's show, which is it out now?
Comes out September 23rd.
There you go. It's also in Men's Magazine this quarter.
Yes, I'm a fashion guy.
What does that mean? Does that mean like you got a spread and everything?
That means he's performing at Roscoe's on Halsted.
No one knows what that means, 80-year-old. That means
I know what that means.
You know, photo shoot. I was very fashionable with my comedy shows, and they did a whole article about me being the in-arena host for the Chicago Bulls last year.
That's right.
And about
right.
Pimprov and all the few things that I'm doing. So yeah, it's
and they dress
great.
and you get to dress up. That's
and I get to dress up and look pretty cool.
That's cool. And Merritt Landsteiner is here. She's a producer and comedian here in Chicago. She produces the show 10 at the Store on the first and third Thursdays of every month. It's at the Store, the bar in Lincoln Park. This Thursday, 9 o'clock. Danny Callis is the headliner.
Yes.
So that's coming up. This would be the third Thursday. I guess that's right.
Yeah, this Thursday. Already. Come on out.
Maybe there she'll we go. Have me in the future.
Hey, sure, there you go.
Yeah.
See,
I'll get you
networking.
On in the future.
This is networking. Right. There we go. All right, so why don't we get right to it, back to it. Let's go to Kathy. Kathy, what's the worst, Kathy?
Hi, my worst is the park sign, the park speed limit sign, which is bounded by Archer Avenue, Ashland, and Wood Street. It's east of Wood Street in Bridgeport area, and there is no park. It's totally residential.
Okay, so it's still, but they have like a no, you can't park, or they have a
no, it's
oh,
a
they
park.
Have a
you have
speed
to lower
limit.
Your speed limit right. Because there's a park. P-A-R-K.
Do you call an alderman on that? What do you do? What do you do with that?
I don't know, but it's really weird. They have it all around McKinley Park, but there's a park area around the whole area.
Right.
But on Archer between Archer between Wood and Ashland, it's a park P-A-R-K speed limit 20 miles an hour during that whole block, and there is not any symbol of a park at all.
Spray black paint on the sign and make sure there are no cameras around.
Well, that's going to be tough.
I would say increase 20 miles per hour.
There you go.
And you'll
all
be
right,
arrested.
Kathy. Well, thank you for that, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Very specific.
I love how specific people are.
But I love it because I'm thinking in my head, I know that area, and I'm like, okay, so where is that? I know Mount McKinley and the whole thing there.
Mm-hmm.
But where? I'm trying to think where there wouldn't be a park on Archer and Ashland. Well,
yeah, I don't know.
All right. Let's go around the table. Mars, what do you got? You got any more?
Yes. The worst is when you give someone your cell phone to take a photo of you and they end up taking a selfie of themselves.
I might have just done that. Hey.
I appreciate it. Now I have a photo of you.
Yeah, exactly. Now you have an embarrassing photo of me that you can use. I did an ugly face.
Like a completely startled, like, is that
you're
me?
Coming up with worst in the moment. I like that. That's a mentality. That's a mindset. I like it.
Improv.
All right, Merritt, what do you got for the worst?
I'd say the worst is that website, Facebook, that website.
Yeah, sure.
When you send someone a message and you can see they read the message and they don't respond, but yet they are posting a bunch on Facebook.
Right,
and it's
right.
like, well,
mm-hmm. Mars
basically Timms. Big, just a big middle finger to you.
I think that, and there was a new thing, I think it was direct messages for Twitter. They're upgrading it. And I think they're rolling it out. I saw this little article where they're going to double down and go to read receipts and all the kind of stuff that, so the idea that happens all the time with Facebook. And I am someone who, I get a lot of messages that come through for Facebook for the job and people want to talk or book things that sometimes you read it and you're like, I don't have time right now because I'm on the show or whatever it is. And you always do feel embarrassed because you're like, oh, well, I didn't get a chance to write back.
Yep.
But Twitter's going even further in that direction, which you're like, I think you would go away from that, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't know what there's, like, people are craving for more information of who read stuff and didn't get back to you, right?
Yeah. I'm scared
Make
of Twitter.
Make me feel worse.
You're scared of Twitter?
I'm scared of Twitter. I'm on Facebook, but I stay the hell away from Twitter.
What scares you about it?
I don't know. It's just, I think when the girl from
Ghostbusters?
No, I can't think of the name of the show. Anyway, she got she said something crazy on it, and she got busted.
Yeah,
and they gave her a lot of flack for it. And somebody,
you can't go on there talking trash.
Yeah, and that's tough when you're a comedian too, because you have to find that line and walk it. And nowadays, it is really hard to walk that line. And
they went after Trevor Noah. Started because years before that, he was trying out material on Twitter that was right on the line, and they were saying that this was inappropriate stuff for him.
Yeah.
I mean that's the problem when you're a comedian trying out jokes that might be a little bit over the line.
Yep.
Yes, yeah. I stay away from Twitter. I was scared of it.
There you go.
5 years ago.
There you go, the worst, Twitter. All right, Pete, you got any more worse?
I have one that's kind of similar to the reading the Facebook message, but this is more personal in that I was at a Cubs game, and I was towards the right field fence, like in the outfield, and one of my buddies is up on a rooftop. I could see him. So I'm like, oh, I got to text him, meet up later. So I text him, I see him, and then I see him pull out his phone, look at it, and then tuck it back.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So it was like,
are you guys still friends?
We're still friends.
Did you text right away, say, I saw you?
Yeah.
No,
you should have been like,
I think I just steamed.
I just saw you.
No, you should have been like, hey, that shirt looks really terrible on you or something.
I just said like, well, hey, what's up or whatever, and
he was like, back not your message.
Wow, that's tough. All right, let's go to the text here. 214 says, the worst is when you're in class and the professor asks a tough question and you know the answer, but you can't raise your hand because of pit stains.
Pit stains?
Yeah, sweaty armpits.
So when all your classmates' eyes make repeated pit stops on your pit stains, that's the worst. Wow, that's the... 847 says, the worst is when your phone, which is also your alarm clock, true, shuts off in the middle of the night. Then you wake up 20 minutes after you should have already been at work.
Yeah.
Why does it shut off? So you got to plug it in.
Yeah, I know. You have the plug right by your bed.
You're assuming that they have a smartphone yours.
Yeah, well, who's got an old brick phone?
I do.
Greg Holloman, 80-year-old comic.
224. What's the worst? People who have to bring their whole family to Walmart or the grocery store. Why do you need mom, dad, five kids, grandma, and grandpa? Make one list. One person can shop. It's not rocket science. Get a grip.
Hey, they're enjoying their family outing.
It's family time.
And
it's
kind of nice,
in the car.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, let them be.
Yeah.
847 says the worst is being 50, living in Rogers Park by the Howard L for 30 years, and now the burbs for 20, and having no idea what the blue, green, red, or brown lines are.
That is pretty sad.
That's pathetic.
Well, I can understand if you were out of town. If you, let's say, you moved out of Chicago in the 90s, you would call the Brown Line the Ravenswood Line.
True.
Yeah. You would call it different things. Yeah. The Howard Line. Like, you wouldn't call it by the colors.
Yeah.
What was the Dan Ryan?
The Red Line, right?
That's the Red Line now, but it wasn't called the Red Line then in the 90s.
No, it was the 95th Street Howard. And yeah, I guess the Blue Line has the hook.
Yeah,
there's a lot of stuff. Green Line does.
Blue is like West Side also. And then there wasn't even a pink line back then, I don't think.
Yeah, so maybe as we work this problem out for 847, we realize that we empathize. We feel for you.
Yeah, that South Red Line was the don't get on this red line if you don't belong.
I grew up on a farm and moved here knowing no one, and I learned them pretty fast. So, you know.
People figure it
just
out.
Just get with it, yeah.
All right, let's keep going. 815 says panhandlers are the worst, and the ones at 290 in Harlem, the worst of the worst.
Hey, man, that's my exit. That's that Harlem 290 exit. That's
815 says the worst, hands down, is when you lay down for bed and a bug flies onto your TV screen. That is funny. Do you lay down and get all comfy?
Yeah.
Right on Jimmy Fallon's head. And you're like, oh, get out of there.
In the middle of Narcos.
Yeah, right. The worst is when your girlfriend makes you laugh so hard while you're brushing your teeth and you start coughing and choking, ultimately throwing up a little and having to start brushing your teeth all over again.
I need that girlfriend.
I was going to say, that doesn't sound like the worst because you're laughing when you're going to bed. That's nice.
You sound happy.
You're too happy to be.
Thanks for rubbing it in, dude.
Then they have amazing sex and sleep sound.
They have
matching. The worst.
Matching pajamas.
The worst. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Two dogs.
All right, here we go. 224 says, the worst is being the only female in a five-person van pool. No.
No one talks. We have to listen to WBBM News repeating every news item and what time it is from 5:45 to 6:30 every morning. Kill me.
That's a winner.
Yeah.
That is a winner. That is
being
good.
The only woman in this room, I hear you.
Now there was just like 45 minutes of news.
Yeah.
All right. And 815's got when a friend calls for help with his car at 3 a.m., but when you drive 30 minutes to help, you find out he called someone else closer who has already showed up and helped, making your trip pointless.
Kill
that,
him.
That's yeah, bad. That's
kill
a winner.
Him. Kill
yeah.
him.
That is a winner. That would bad. Really yeah. make me mad.
That would make me mad, too. I understand the plight, though. You know, when, yeah. when you got a flat or something, you're like...
calling everybody.
Yeah, you're calling everybody.
Yeah, you're calling
but
everybody.
Text an update saying someone
yeah,
else
right.
is there.
Yeah, right. That seems like technology would be there for you to fix that situation.
Yeah, mass text.
Mars Timms, Greg Holloman, Merritt Landsteiner in studio. All right, 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. Our last break will come back, and we will give you the winners from tonight's The Worst.
Oh,
stay wow. with us.
Going down.
815 says the worst is when you drive an hour to Chicago to have a reunion with your college boyfriend of 40 years ago, thinking romantic thoughts, and when you meet him, he introduces you to his 26-year-old girlfriend.
Oh,
shame on you.
Oh,
shame.
That's the worst.
At least give her a heads up before
yeah, right?
that the 26-year-old girlfriend's going to be there.
Yeah, like,
even
again.
People spring crap like that
again,
on others.
Again, text, right? That's yeah. the whole thing.
But that was
or
her.
Included in the email. I don't
she
know.
She went in there thinking that. The, yeah. You don't know that the guy, like, told her that. He was like, oh, I can't wait to see you.
I'll and be great to see you. Yeah.
yeah.
Right.
I mean, know.
That long.
Merritt's feeling it. She's really trying to unpack this one.
I can't agree with you on that one, Mayor.
All right. 224. But the worst, this is good. The worst is when you get to the age, both chronologically and physically, where you start listening to all the ED commercials and wondering which one really works.
Yeah, I do wonder.
773 says, when someone in your family who you love very much cannot stop with the humble bragging. It's cool. We know you're awesome. Stop it.
Yes. Humble bragging is the worst.
And 773 says, the worst is when you're broke, so you borrow money only to find some money you hid from yourself a week later.
Squirrel.
That's all good.
Drinking problem.
Yeah, right?
Why were you hiding the money from yourself?
All right, let's get to some of these callers. Adam, what's the worst, Adam?
Hi there.
Hi.
It was probably about circa, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, and back when, you know, chat rooms were kind of still a thing. Sure. And, you know, you get used to using the lingo, you know, like LOL and all that stuff. And I when I type, I kind of mouth my words while I talk, you know, like, you know, and I was on all day on the computer and, like, you know, in this stupid chat room. And I had to get up and go to the bank before it closed, and while I was in line, I was talking to the teller, and she said something funny, and I actually said the word LOL out loud. Like, you know, I laughed, and I was like, ah, LOL. And she was like, what? You know, and I was like, oh, nothing, you know. And then she knew what I had said, and she, you know, I just sit there, you know, the whole time, and I just felt like an idiot. So
you should have pawned it off like you're you know, I'm sorry, I work in tech.
Yeah,
I work in tech. I just
I didn't know what to say. I said it so plainly, and she knew what I said. And she was like, what? And I was like, oh, no, I was just yeah. I don't remember.
You wouldn't understand. You wouldn't understand. You're not
so
as cool as me.
I just yeah, that was my. I just thought of that one.
If she was cute, well, you could have said lots of love. I don't know.
I should have tried that next
time. Next
time.
Thanks, Adam. Appreciate it. That and then finally Carol, what's the worst, Carol?
Oh, the worst. Did you actually already have me? Did you?
I did.
Was going to the drive-in movie. I was one of the first callers.
Oh, great. Yeah, okay.
You got it already?
Yeah, I got it. Thank you for that. I don't know what you're talking about. Could be from a different episode. Okay, so we got all the stuff. I want to thank the panel that's here, Merritt Landsteiner. You can check her out, 10 at the store, first and third Thursdays at the store in Lincoln Park. This Thursday, 9 o'clock, Danny Callis is the headliner, stand-up showcase.
He's
Mars
funny.
Timms, there you go, Mars Timms, who does Pimprov at the Chemically Imbalanced Theater, CIC, 1422 West Irving Park every Friday night. You can also check him out at the Improv in October. He's opening for Whitney Cummings. He's also in the new Joe Swanberg's Netflix show, Easy.
And Greg Holloman, great to see you. Greg Holloman, who is also in Pimprov. His show Shrink, or he's on the show Shrink. It's on CISO, of course, from Strangers with Candy, which was a tremendous hit 20 years ago.
Loved it. Thank
you. It's one of the best shows ever.
Curse.
All right, so we got the top three. Let's go through this. Let me read. I got to do this. I got to read the prizes. So for third place, you're going to get a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza.
Mm.
Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. Second place is going to get you a pair of tickets to the Barty Bunch, playing at the Mercury Theater Chicago from September 15th to November 20th. Come on, get happy at this musical parody mashup of a dozen Shakespeare plays set in the 70s and featuring the warring sitcom families Brady and Partridge.
Mm.
Get tickets at mercurytheaterchicago.com or call 773-325-1700. And first place is going to get you a pair of tickets to the sold-out Chicago Blackhawks Training Camp Festival on Saturday, September 24th, inside the United Center. The Outdoor Free Festival starts at 8 a.m. and doors to inside open at 9 a.m. The first 10,000 fans to enter receive a Brent Seabrook bobblehead.
Whoa!
There you go. There you go. All right. So we've picked our three. So
effects.
Why don't we do this? Number three tonight, if you guys are ready. That's a little drum roll. There you go. Number three. You know what's the worst? Goatees.
Yep.
Goatees gets third place.
CC Soul Patch.
That's right. There you go. All right. So we are on our way. So third place. All right. So second place tonight comes from 815, and it says, when a friend calls for help with his car at 3 a.m., but when you drive 30 minutes to help, you find out he called someone else closer who's already showed up and helped, making your trip point.
That should have been number one.
That's ridiculous, right?
That is ridiculous. I feel her on that one.
It's the worst, really, because with the advent of technology, a text could easily be like, yo, just called someone, Rick's coming by.
And even if you didn't have texting, call them back.
Right. Yeah. Maybe a phone died in there. I don't know, but it's just that is the worst.
Yeah.
3 a.m.
Your phone died in the middle of the night, even though you were charging it. What? Isn't that somebody that called?
That was somebody, right. All right,
you're
and 224.
Really yeah.
really. Sticking it to the man. All right, so number one tonight comes from 224. The worst being the only female in a 5-person van pool. No one talks. We have to listen to WBBM News repeating every news item and what time it is from 5:45 to 6:30 every morning.
It's 10:58.
That is true. Just the idea of that visual of you sitting in the van at 6 o'clock just being like, nobody's talking and everybody's shoulder to shoulder in a van.
Yep.
That just sounds like the worst.
That's guys, though. That's guys in the morning. I know.
Guys don't talk in the morning.
Guys rarely talk, but in the morning,
coffee,
definitely,
You know what you should try to do, 224, is you should try and see one day, just go, hey, I don't know, can we listen to Eric and Kathy? See what happens. Or even better, hey, you know what? Steve Cochran's really good on WGN, and see if they go for it. Right?
Yeah,
just
go
get
for
out
it.
Of the to change the routine up.
Right? That's what I do.
You show them who's boss.
That's right. That's right. Merritt Landsteiner, Mars Timms, Greg Holloman. Thanks, guys. Great to see you guys.
Thank you
thanks
so
for
much.
Having us on here.
Yeah,
man.
Thank you,
Justin Kaufman. That's the guy right there.
That's a man. Right?
All right, that's going to do it for us tonight. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. Patty Vasquez coming up next. Pretty late with Patty Vasquez. Tomorrow, Christine Sneed, great novelist, getting great reviews for her new book. She will be my guest at the big table. Also, big picnic tomorrow, Rob. We're going to go Anthony Rizzo.
Oh.
Right? See, we made it. Can you believe it? We made it.
Wheels are already turning.
Anthony Rizzo tomorrow and then Jake Arrieta the week after. That's how we're going to finish it out.
The big Riz.
The big it's already there. Esmeralda, you got to get into the soundproof booth.
Pasta man.
So I'm not going to be here.
No, we didn't time it right.
I'm going to be in Boston.
Oh, nice. That's nice, though.
Till Tuesday. So.
All right. Well,
macaroni and Rizzo.
Oh, boy.
We will. Who's in for you? Do you know?
Meat sauce.
I believe it is Mr. Roger Badish.
Okay, so Badish will be the man. All right. Well, we'll miss you. We'll miss you this week. Have a great time in
Thank
Boston.
You. Thank you. I trust Rogers.
And then you'll be back for next Wednesday.
Yes.
We'll do Jake Arrieta. All right. Patty's up next.